Greetings, Warp Explorers. Welcome to X-Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become if you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X-Squared Radio. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and the Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysms? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in this series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com. Get your autograph copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. Good evening, Earth Explorers. Brooks Agnew here. The solar wind tonight is a brisk 577.3 kilometers per second at the moment. There are no real sunspots to speak of, only tiny 896 is making its way across our view. One thing you might want to watch for, if you have a good set of binoculars or a fair telescope, asteroid 2004 XP14 will pass as close as the moon to the Earth on July 3rd. This rock is 600 meters in diameter and will only take 4 hours to pass through the Milky Way. Right after sunset this week, you should be able to see Saturn and Mars very close to one another in the early evening sky. You can see the reddish tint of Mars next to the dazzling brightness of Saturn with the naked eye. But if you have a local astronomy club, you might like to get down there this week and climb a stepladder to look through their telescope. They'd love to have you. And yes, it's always free to the public. Don't worry about the lights not being on. Astronomers hang out in pitch blackness, and I guarantee they will be there this week. You see, the population of the skies overhead can change very quickly, so make sure you don't leave home angry with anyone you love. If you want to stay current on our programs, guests, books, CDs, DVDs, and other outstanding stuff for your space, you can make X-Squared Radio your favorite place on the web at x2-radio.com. We also want to thank BBS Radio Network and Global Star Radio Networks for carrying X-Squared Radio. Without them, you wouldn't be able to hear us or participate in the program. We have been making a grand attempt to bring you this program free of any charges by asking you to make your purchases for cool stuff for your space through X-Squared Radio. Telescopes, artwork, unique clothing, gifts, and even inkjet supplies can be purchased through X-Squared Radio. We have been searching for a suitable food storage company to offer you, but so far, no outlets meet my standards. As soon as I find a food storage company that can deliver what we think you need, then we'll offer you that as well. Next week on our program, we have Brent Miller coming back to discuss remote viewing, the Horizon Project, and how it is possible for you to discover your own optimum trajectory in life. Each of us have a perfect set of skills and talents that make us individuals and would be most fulfilled doing certain things while here on the earth. If you'd like to find out how that works, or if you are just interested in knowing what some of the best remote viewers in the world are saying, you need to tune in. Please tell your friends as well. We are on the air before most football games or auto races, so you need to get this in you. Don't forget to visit our online store. We have added some of the best CDs on the planet for space fans. We also carry the books of our guests, so if you are listening to an archive and you want the books mentioned on the program, you can easily click into that area and pick up the book or DVD. You also want to sign up for our newsletter. We send some really neat specials out each month. This month, we are adding some 3D software for exploring space for free to anyone who buys a copy of The Ark of Millions of Years. Tonight, our guest is Marco Rodin. He is a world-recognized mathematician and an inventor. His Rodin toroidal coil produces many times more magnetism than coils of equal size. Like many mathematicians before him, I feel he reached out into the source of all knowledge and knew what he was looking for. He saw the patterns of math in nature, music, and even the Holy Scriptures, and was able to grasp the language of creation from them. He is able to prove that numbers are real and alive, and hopefully tonight you will become better friends with the one discipline that intimidates almost everyone. Marco and I discussed in writing the mud between math and physics. Well, let's go ahead and get off in the mud. So please welcome with me Marco Rodin. How are you tonight?
I'm doing great, thank you.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you on. I've read a lot of the research papers and a lot of the comments of other scientists who have utilized some of your ideas. I found it both overwhelming and fascinating. Mm-hmm. Most people think that physicists are great mathematicians. I'd like to set the record straight. To me, that means we can work the formulas and derivations as well as they were intended, but that we tend to think in probabilities and possibilities of the origins or destinies of things and not necessarily what can I do with the math that's never been done before. But frankly, I don't personally know many real mathematicians. I know people who can work math. When I begin to catch the vision you try to draw in your papers or is drawn by those who read your stuff, my tendency is to see possibilities. It's overloaded. So you have discovered a link between math and physics that is more than, well, what I term quantum foam. So what would you like to do first? I think I'd like to ask you how you reached the end of known math and saw something others did not see. What got you so interested in it?
Okay. I try and be as on the bullseye, direct. I try and be on target and answer your questions the best I can. The truth is my greatest ability deals with sounds. I call it biophysical harmonics as it relates to the brain.
Mm.
Sounds are sometimes referred to as resonance or vibration, oscillation. Those principles apply as well to electrical engineering and to electrical coils. But my personal quest is to the brain. And the ultimate coil is the human brain. Our body's called this mortal coil. But the human brain has a coil. Every coil does one of two things. It transmits and it receives. And in every religion, metaphysical practice, it's taught that if the brain is properly, if you get the perfect encephalogram waveform, that you can have divine guidance, that you can have the apex of consciousness, and then you can tap into those paranormal things that we all believe in that are so fleeting and rare, such as telekinesis or psychicness or levitation. Many people are highly consumed by those topics, such as levitation. The ultimate machine is the human temple, not some external peripheral device. While I make electrical coils that get double the output, still anything peripheral to the human body is secondary. And so I learned the mathematics because I was studying, of all things, religious scripture. In the major religions such as the Quran, the Bible, the Torah, their scripture was written in Aramaic, Arabic, Hebrew, Farsi, which is Persian, Arabic. They have a system in that language that every person who speaks that language adheres to, be it literally many billions of people. They all do not deviate from the mathematics of that language. That's called Abjad, A-B-J-A-D, Abjad Numerical Notation System. It's so pervasive that there isn't a single person who speaks that language know that the Aleph, which represents all the vowels and is the first letter of the language, there's not a person that doesn't know that the Aleph doesn't equal the number one, which represents God. So in studying all of the religions, it became apparent to me in deepening that the most sacred holy thing was their name of God in the scriptures. In the Baha'i Faith, it's referred to as the most great name of God. And that was a mathematical pattern. In the Baha'i scriptures, it said that the mathematics for the name of God, the most great name of God, equaled the number nine. And that the number nine represented the complete fulfillment of all knowledge. It was like the sun at noon at its most and greatest intensity. The number nine was the zenith. So I studied the letters of the alphabet of Persian, Arabic, etc., studying on the mathematical pattern of the name of God because I wanted to have the correct intonation. It's called the precise mystic intonation of the most great name of God. I wanted to know how to say it correctly. It was very apparent to me as I was saying it very slowly that I wasn't accomplishing anything. I wasn't doing it right. And so I wanted to follow the number pattern to see how to say the syllables or to combine the syllables. I wanted to see what I could find. I learned mathematics to model sounds, to model the name of God.
How fascinating. So do you dream in math, too? I mean, mathematics?
I don't think I can't recollect ever having a numerical dream.
I dream sometimes
the most altered state dreams is, you know, you'll hear buzzings, high pitched mm-hmm. buzzing, you know. They're altered states, but okay.
Well, sometimes I hear music or patterns or sometimes see relationships in my dreams. That's what kind of inspired me to be, you know, go beyond chemistry and learn physics was not the relationship of chemicals, but the relationship of planets and light and energy and even the souls of men. So, and sometimes maybe you do the same thing. When you hear music, do you see or experience the mathematics of it?
I certainly have had a lot of fun with weird dreams. I don't know what to make of it, and honestly, it's just so silly. Like I once, Jethro Tull. Whenever I get to feel this way, it's a beautiful song. It just came as crystal clear. It was like I was listening to the radio. As far as dream, in my present age, and I'm 50 years old, they don't really are not involving me in my thoughts and my research and my work. As a child, I used to have a trilogy, three dreams I used to go over and over again. They were really more like nightmares. They motivated me. It was pretty simple stuff. The second dream was I get in a car and I can't reach the brakes and I can't stop. As far as my actual work, it's all been done. There's a saying by an artist I worked with, very talented, Richard Karsgaard. He used to say that artwork, he was a great calligraphist, is 1% inspiration and 90% work, 90% effort. 1% inspiration, 90% perspiration. I think the question you're answering me is how did I understand or get to this understanding? Because
yeah,
I did have a spontaneous all at once experience. If you'd like that, I can answer that.
Right. Well, I just know at least from my reading and when I teach chemistry, there's this sort of moment at which confusion becomes an explosion of light and understanding. It's a point at which, you know, people realize, hey, I understand this, and it has a profound effect upon them. Not just the classwork that they do, but the way that they think, and sometimes even I have people come in and say, hey, I dreamt about, you know, stoichiometry last night, and I really understand how to balance equations now. So I thought, if I ever got a chance to interview a really good mathematician, do you dream or imagine, or did you have some kind of esoteric epiphany of, you know, when math became more than just...
Well, I can answer that, bro.
Something
I know
there.
Exactly what you're referring to. It's a specific moment.
Yeah.
But it wasn't a dream. It'll take me about 3 or 4 minutes to give you your answer.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. I'd been sent away to boarding school. It was a school for kids out of control that were wild. I ended up getting thrown out of it. They sent me back home. My dad was very nice about it. He said, well, I'm surprised you lasted as long as you did. I didn't think you're going to make it. But in the school, it was pretty wild. And I got in a fight with somebody. I never touched him. He'd insulted a girl all day. We were sitting by the pool. And anyway, he said something to her. He was walking by again. I said, you can't say that. He was a Golden Glove boxer, a very short guy, 4 foot something, 6 or 7. Hit me in the nose. I said, you can't say that to her. And he walked up to me, hit me in the nose, and didn't even watch, turned around and walked off. He knew that I was wiped out, that he had pulverized me. Blood was pouring out of my nose, literally flattened me. He damaged me so bad that I ended up having to have 16 surgeries to straighten out the bones and everything in there.
Wow.
Yeah, it was quite a blow. Changed my whole life, probably saved my life, because prior to then I was literally as wild as could be. So I was now back home, and I had a tremendous problem breathing, and I was completely slowed down. So I was literally always partially crippled trying to recuperate. And at that moment when I had this experience, I was always fighting and struggling to use my brain and to breathe, to exert my faculties just to function normal, which I attribute to that effort to being able to function, having to make a bigger effort than an average person would be. I focused that and I guided that. I was laying in my sister's bed. I was in her room. She had just remodeled it. There was a Persian rug on the floor. It was a hardwood floor, a chandelier, oiled lantern chandelier. And my room wasn't as attractive as hers. She wasn't home, and I was laying on her bed. It was a canopy bed with my head on the pillow. I didn't have the strength to go outside to even walk. Just complete exhaustion, just laying there with my head back on the pillow. And I said to myself, what is the secret of intelligence? What is the secret of how to tap into the underutilized remaining, as most scientists believe, 90% potential, remaining potential of the brain? And I immediately referred to what their common consensus was, and every scientist said that hereditary wasn't a factor in genius. IQ was not a result of culture. You don't get it from going to certain schools, you know, genius. They really don't know. And they said they didn't know. It's not race. It's not culture. So I decided to do an experiment in my brain. All my life, I had a good education in elementary school, good science teachers, and I was taught to use as best you can. Ultimately, there is no such thing as a control, but to try and use... to create an experiment and use scientific method and partiality. And so I said, well, I'll pick the smartest person on Earth and I'll pick the smartest life form on another planet outside the solar system. So I thought as far as I could outside of our solar system, to as far as I could push my mind to the other side of the universe. I didn't see anything. I make that real clear when I share this story that it was just a thought experiment in my mind. I really wasn't on the other side of the universe, but I thought I was way out there, and I traveled, and I picked a planet where there was some other form of intelligent life form, not mankind. And then I thought of who would be the most intelligent person on this planet. In those days, Nixon was in office, I believe, and I picked Kissinger, who was highly renowned. And I started listening to a speech pattern, which was monotonous, rambling on, the world will have, and just endless. And he got to a third sentence in the world, and he hit a flag, a marker, a tone, he said, and all of a sudden he hit a pitch, and it was a trigger point. I realized that he wasn't doing mental gymnastics, trying to think ahead of all the things he had to share, and his mind wasn't revving and racing forward. Rather, he had these tones that would release a total onslaught, like a torrent of information that would just flow out. And it was all controlled by harmonics, by tones. And I started thinking, well, his native language, his native name, how does this influence him? He has a German name. How does it affect his intelligence? And then I remembered that in the Torah, in the Bible, in the Quran, that the name of God was said, like in the Bible it says, the name of God is the keys to heaven's gate. The name of God unlocks the gates of heaven. That's what it says. And I took that literally. Everything's about the name of the God in Scriptures. I mean, how many times as adults and children have we said, what in the name of God are you doing, or something?
Yeah.
Every science fiction movie, you know, has to do with, what in God's name. And I took that not as a name, like ours, but as the primal name that was the source, and it says this, in the name of God is the source of creation. The name of God, and this takes us into a topic that is, I don't want to endlessly jump into, but the name of God, so the world, the creation is mechanical. God had an agency. God may be totally omnipotent. I certainly believe that. But he still created our world using the physics and the priorities, the axioms of his name. And so I use the mathematics of the name of God to understand then electrical engineering, genetics, space power propulsion systems to go anywhere in the universe. Essentially, I became a puppy mill production house, mass producing products, all using the schematic, the blueprint of the name of God to miraculously go beyond what existing technology can do.
Wow. So now one of the things that mathematicians usually see, and I know when I get into, when I teach college algebra, I run across this too, and we start discussing patterns in nature. But mathematicians have a unique perspective when they look at nature, like, I can't help but think of a man whose name was Leonardo Pisano. I guess his nickname is Fibonacci. And he was born in 1170, lived a very rare age of 80. And he...
In those days, he would be three generations.
Yeah, I mean, that's like us living to be 200, considering how terrible their hygiene was in those days. I mean, this is Black Plague days, and he lives to be 80.
I was told that in the day of Christopher Columbus, the average age was 27 years old for the average person.
Goodness, that's just phenomenal. But in nature, there's a pattern of counting, which has been termed Fibonacci numbers. And simply put, you know this, but my guests probably are, my listeners probably don't, that the next number in the Fibonacci counting sequence is the sum of the previous two numbers. And it's a code. It's used in, honeycombs and seashells and all kinds of different things, flowers. But Leonardo saw this pattern in the breeding of rabbits.
Right.
And he goes on to explain his theories, which are quite sound, and we still use them today. And I think they were mentioned in the recent Da Vinci Code even. They use Fibonacci numbers, so I guess they can sound smart. I don't know.
But well, it's a standard, and it's got all the it has credence.
Yeah,
it's been applied. It's been so heavily applied to biology. They know it's pervasive in everything.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how does it occur in your theories? You know, how does this work?
Well, I sewed it up. I don't like acting overly confident, but first of all, though, in mathematics today, they oversimplify things and they try and put it on a single plane on a flat piece of paper.
Sure.
That's referred to as 2D. In reality, the two dimension doesn't exist. It's a part of other dimensions that are higher. The Fibonacci sequence, while it is a pattern, it's only a perspective of something that's much greater. An example would be like you do a cross section of, let's say, an apple. Okay, you'll see the inside. You'll see something else. Then there's a cross section, vertical, horizontal. Then there's the outside surface view. The Fibonacci is mathematical pattern is just one different view of something greater. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm, sure.
The person I was reaching out, and somebody I was referred to, and I shared my work with him. He says I don't have the ability to understand it, but he said there's this man named Alistair Cooper. I have tremendous respect for him. He says would you have him assess your work? I'd be interested in his opinion. He lives on Maui. He's very good in engineering. And I contacted him, and I said, Alistair, pick anything, one thing that you want, and I can show you that with this math that I've discovered, I'll get endless reams of more data and information that your abilities using conventional math would never even come close to. I can give you new data that would have been impossible otherwise. So he picked the Fibonacci sequence. The first thing that I showed him...
That was his mistake, wasn't it? That was his mistake, wasn't it?
Well, it was a blessing to me because I had up to that point in my life, I never had approached it. I hadn't tackled it.
Oh.
So it was new to me at that time,
mm-hmm.
as still many things are. So he, because of the fact that not only did I solve it for him, but because I went ahead and, proves the authenticity of this math that I use. He devoted his time and himself to my work, and he actually then after I showed him the relationship of the Fibonacci sequence to this discovery, to a toroid, to a vortex, he went ahead and wrote an article which I think is still online. I don't off the top of my head remember the name of the article, but it was, and I can barely understand half of it, but it certainly inspired a lot of physicists and other engineers to write articles online about my work based on his article. Anyway, the answer to the Fibonacci sequence, first of all, is this. The Fibonacci sequence is not an endless series. It's not an infinite series. After the 24th digit, the pattern repeats. What you do, although the numbers appear to grow as a large number digit pattern, as complex or compound numbers, like it goes... 1, 1, 2, 3, then what's the next number?
5. And then
8.
And then 13.
Okay. What you do is every time you get to a large number, the next number where it's 13 after 8,
mm-hmm.
you go 1 plus 3 is 4.
Yeah.
Okay. You reduce it to a discrete number. That's called a digital root. It's just a single digit. After 24 digits, the pattern repeats over and over again. Do you follow that?
Huh. And that's if you add all the digits together. So
like yeah, like 20. Numerology, like casting out 9, cross addition, horizontal math. You're not looking at the values of the numbers. You're looking for a number pattern. We want the pattern. Because patterns are a part of geometry. Okay? So you're trying to deduce or sluice out the physical properties of the Fibonacci sequence. Okay? Are you still with me?
So what you're saying is that you can actually root out or distill infinity.
Using my work, I have shown that, number one, infinity, as we understand it on the third dimension, is definitely not infinite. Infinity is not infinity of direction. Infinity is what I refer to as a bounded infinity. It complies with the classic laws of Einstein, the curvature of space-time reality, theory of relativity, curvature of the universe. Infinity, classically, when we draw it as a lazy eight, as a Mobius, it warps and curves like a bow tie. I show that infinity is a bounded infinity that's an infinity of a spin continuum. It's endless in its motion. It's like a circuit. Okay? It never stops, but it's a bounded infinity. It's a spin continuous infinity of duration, not direction. Because the thing that creates infinity on its axis where it overlaps is infinity's epicenter. If there's an invisible spindle and axis there, literally that emanates, causes infinity to, while it moves, as it warps and processes, it causes it to turn, but it causes it to come back upon itself as well. Hmm. There is a numerical pattern for infinity, and there's only six numbers in it. Okay?
Six.
There's only six numbers in infinity.
I can learn six numbers.
You can. I will be glad to share with you to give you the numerical pattern for infinity. It happens to be, of all things, you'll never believe it, it happens to be the same numerical pattern for the binary code for computers, and it's the same numerical pattern for all biology, of the biology of growth. It's a universal principle, all pervasive, everything conforms to it. You still with me?
Sure.
Okay. So let's take the classical, it's called, you're a physicist. It's called as one neutrino liberates two neutrinos liberates four. That's called what? A chain reaction.
Right.
Is there another term for a chain reaction, or is that it?
Well, yeah, there is. It depends on the growth pattern. It can be exponential. It can be doubling. In a chain reaction, you have 1 to 2 to 4 to 8 to 16, and so forth, and then it expands. The curve goes practically, straight up, although it's asymptotic.
Okay. You're such a courteous host. You don't point out that I have zero education. I barely made it through high school. So I'm going to share with you the numerical pattern for infinity, and then I'm going to ask you to explain it in your terms or apply it to things you understand. That I don't have the ability to do, okay?
Well, first of all, let me just parenthetically say that I think the monopoly that organized, quote-unquote, education has had upon the alphabet soup that goes behind names is quickly dissolving as brilliant minds such as yourself gain access to unlimited knowledge through the Internet and through other libraries and different forms. And you have the thirst or the hunger to consume it all, you will so quickly outstrip organized education. It isn't funny.
The only thing, though, is that academia never, ever hindered my growth. Conventional education is not to blame that my knowledge or information or discovery is not out there. The reason that my knowledge isn't out there is all my fault, and because for two reasons. One is I don't have the resources to devote the energy and time because I live in a day-to-day struggle. And the other reason is because, as unpleasant it is to bring up, the world's at war, has been and will continue to be. And while I can live with or die with my discovery being used destructively, the problem is I just don't want to. I don't want to see it swallowed up and buried and vanish. And because of that, I can't use conventional patent methods. I can't use my discovery to market per se safely. and for it to still endure. So what I've tried to do is document it, preserve it in a book, put it up online, and I have literally, I went over my work. We have almost 100 gigs of data. A lot of it's redundant. I've got only like a zillionth, just a trivial bit of it up online. And the problem is that I can't apply for grants. I can't go out there because I obsolete everything they do. And I, while they don't fully believe me or realize it to date, I certainly could prove it, and I don't want to then, I didn't do the work for them. I did it for the average person, for it to be shared across the board with the general public. Anyway, so ultimately, it's always been my responsibility to get this out. And I did discover it without the benefit of conventional, classical understanding. But I will continue. Along the lines of infinity. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
The number one doubled is 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128, 256, 512, 1024, etc.
Correct.
Okay. Repeat, when that number's pattern actually curves back on itself, and that is a loop. Okay, it is a circuit.
Mm-hmm.
It is not a straight line. It warps, just like the universe warps. So what happens is the number one is where I began. The first number to repeat the number one is the number 64, which 6 plus 4 equals 10 and 1 plus 0 equals 1.
Mm-hmm.
Very hard for the average listener to be comfortable with simple reduction, okay, which is going 64 equals 1. Okay, it's a pain in the butt. But 6 plus 4 equals 10, 1 plus 0 equals 1.
Right.
Okay. I could have said, what's 64 divided by 9? I forget.
64 is not divisible by 9.
Oh, I mean, it's not evenly. But what is it equal? 9 times...
7 point...
Something.
9... 1,
1. 9 times 7 is 63. You have a remainder of 1.
Mm-hmm.
That's why 64 equals 1. It's a little weird, huh?
Yeah, 7.11111 repeating...
Okay, but I'm not rounding off the decimal. Okay, that is a lot of people. You can never in the mathematics that I have discovered round off a decimal. I get there is no such thing as an endless non-repeating decimal.
Right.
I can take any value and get and have it as a whole number, even what before has been an endless non-repeating decimal. But let me continue along with the pathway of infinity. So 64 was a 1. The next number after 64, which is doubling, is 128, which equals 11, which equals 2.
Right.
Okay. And again, if we had divided 128 divided by 9, we would have had a remainder of 2. Now, of course, in the binary code, 1 doubled is 2. The next number after 2 is going to be 4. And 128 doubled is 256 equals 13 equals 4.
Right.
Okay. Next number doubled, 256 doubled is 512 equals 8. Do you see we just repeated the pattern of the binary code?
We sure did.
Yeah.
1, 2, 3.
The only confusion to the average viewer would be that after 8 comes 7, after 7 comes 5, and then the 1 again. Because 1024 equals 7.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is that being an engineer yourself, 1, 2, 4, 8, 7, 5 is the perfect sine wave, because as you're increasing going up, I forget what that term is, when your telephone number is the same number and then it mirrors in the center and then reverses out the other side. What's that called? Polydrome? No, there's another word for it.
I can't remember. I know
what
you're talking about.
Okay, that's what 1, 2, 4, 8, 7, 5 is.
Like 9, 1, 1, 9.
Right. 1, 2, 4, 8, 7, 5, because you see... What I've done is I've taken unity, which is the number one, 100%, and I've gone away in both directions. As you go to the right, which is one, you're going backwards, which is a five, and a half. They're reciprocals, because two times 0.5 equals one. So now watch. This is going to be a little rascally, a little tenuous, but now I'm going to go to the right, which is two doubled is four. I'm going to go to the left, which is 1.5 is going to be one backwards, which is halved. Is going to be 0.25, which equals 7, and that's 157. because I'm always the same distance from one. There's a geometry in infinity that what you do, you must do consistently across the board. So if I go two spaces to the right with the geometry to equal unity or one, I must go two spaces to the left.
Right. There's no such thing as negative distance. You're talking about absolute values.
That's right. And I can do this because of the fact I get rid of all the hyperbole of conventional mathematics. All the things that they do in conventional mathematics I show is false.
Well, it needs to be because mathematics is satisfying to get the right answer, but it's more satisfying to look at a problem in nature and or in engineering and be able to solve it by using mathematics. Now I'm a fairly strong statistician, so when I go into manufacturing facilities, what I see in their processes are all the variations. So I see their whole process in math, and the solution, rears its head easily for me because I can just do the math and it pops out. But when you're going through this discovery process, I can hear the excitement in your voice, and it's infectious, frankly. Do you think the presence of these mathematical sequences and the patterns that you see and the loops that you see is proof of the involvement of an intelligent mind in creation? Certainly all of this didn't render itself as a finished product by some random process. It sounds quite designed, doesn't it?
Turing tried to create the ultimate calculating machine. I have found, I can literally see, the saying is, I think it was, who was it, Escher, Bach, was, the goal was to, if one could just take a glimpse, get a glimpse of the mind of God, just have a, what I've been able to do is I've been able to find perfection. I've been able to prove that there is a God, an all-coherent intelligence. It doesn't mean that God is limited or reduced down to our world. But what I'm able to see is I'm able to see spirit. I found that it's beyond the scope of the description that I've given the audience so far, and I'm just kind of catapulting myself in more to the forefront of the topic. The nature of numbers, every number is created along a z-axis by a positive emanation, which can be called spirit, prana, chi. In science, it can be called a monopole, dark matter, dark energy, tachyon, inertia, ether. It has a harmonic, it has a phasing, a pulse, a tempo, a firing rate, an activation sequence. It doesn't do justice. Anything that I would try to... any information that I would share, it would just limit it. Spirit is constantly being renewed in our world.
Mm-hmm.
It is the source of the existence of our world. If it was to cease, our universe would instantly also become null and void. It has, though, a signature. This is every antenna, every transmitter has a waveform, has a signature.
Mm-hmm.
So does spirit. The requirement or the litmus test for spirit is that it has to be able to cover every mathematical function, every single last known mathematical calculation or formula or equation. Anything... with the requirement that if anything is duplicated twice, then the discovery is false, or if there's anything that is omitted, there is no omission, there's no redundancy. So the end-all conclusion is that, and I'm sorry that the audience doesn't know what a toroid is, but is that all mathematics, all physics, all science, everything ultimately, the grand unified field theory, the fountain of youth, the mind of God, is in the shape of a toroid, a donut.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the body's called, to try and not make a toroid seem like some alien UFO, never-to-be-understood thing, a toroid is, like a saucer, is a donut. The saying is about a donut is the secret of the donut is a hole. Everything is based on the donut. Our blood cells are little like dimpled hockey pucks, which are toroidal in shape.
Mm-hmm.
Our body is even named after the toroid. Our body is called the human torso. In electricity, anything that warps or spins, we refer to it as electrical torsion. I have found the source of all torsion, the source of warpage, the source of spin. It was said by Tom, I won't say his last name, at General Dynamics, that I discovered the source of the non-decaying spin of the electron. He was a laser optics specialist. Everything, when it takes its maximum accelerated speed, its maximum accelerated pathway, makes the shape of the donut. Our solar system, the Milky Way, is a spiral vortex. That's what a vortex is. It's a donut. It implodes, explodes, compresses, decompresses. It's based on a two-stage surge pump of negative vortex to positive vortex, in and out, which is driven by the emanation coming from the center of the donut, the inner diameter.
Mm-hmm.
There must always be a hole. If there's no, that's where the zero is. The zero is the hole of the vortex. Nothing touches the center. Everything goes around the lip.
Right.
And defines the, it's like a camera shutter, just the inner diameter, the ID of the vortex. Were you going to say something?
Well, I was going to ask, you know, is a soul a toroid, a torus as well?
You know, just like everyone else, I contemplate the immortality of the human soul and how it's the first to recognize God and acknowledge God. But the truth is the one topic that I claim profess complete ignorance of, is the soul. It's a mystery to me too. I can model spirit. I know where spirit is in the underpinning geometry of space. I know when, where, and what moment spirit is, and I can tap into it to make even electricity. You know, I that's why my coils get so much more magnetic inductance. But when it comes to the soul, that is outside of my purview.
We're going to talk about your coils a little bit more in the next hour. One question I wanted to ask you, I don't know if you had any readings of this or have done any exploration in this. Do you think the ancients understood this this kind of mathematical technology, the theory of numbers and the patterns that you've discovered?
There's two groups of ancients of the past. There was the generality of mankind, who it was kept shielded from, who was considered unworthy of this knowledge, and because of that was deliberately kept ignorant, because the ones in possession of this knowledge of the ancients felt that the generality of mankind would desecrate it and defile it. But then there was the group that received their information from the endless manifestations of God and the endless prophets of God, roughly that came every thousands of years through the past, that brought earlier religions that even there's no record of, that the changes of the earth, the earthquakes have swallowed up. This knowledge has always been a part of religion. It's always been a part of God's teachings. It's the secret of illumination. It's the secret of enlightenment. It's the secret of God's intermediary on any level, from communion, divine guidance, to space travel, to freedom from toil and sin. How to tap into the full potential of the brain, any avenue, direction that you want to take it in. It's always existed with mankind. The difference is today mankind's reached a level of maturity that I would like to share it with mankind, that every person is capable of independent investigation of truth. So the difference is I made a discovery. It comes out of the scriptures, and all my goal is just to share it and preserve it, which I've done a lousy job. I have to...
Well, we're doing a good job of it here tonight. We're going to discuss it in as much depth as a dumb old engineer and a odd listening audience can understand.
Brooks, My favorite thing is to show the relationship to ancient cultures, the connection, where they left the clues. It's the ultimate mystery. So I'd be glad to do a show where they've left us, you know, hidden information. The classic is the pyramid.
Yeah.
I'd be glad to address that.
We are, at least as engineers, hung up on how they could have completed such a structure in 20 years. Just the mere fact that they had to quarry, haul, and stack stone at such an incredible rate that there's no engineering group or force today that could build such a structure. We're kind of hung up on that, but the setting of it, the alignment of the cardinal points, the perfection of the mathematics, the presence of very powerful magnetic vortexes in that area, those are the baffling parts. And the fact that very recently, like in the last couple of months, there's been an even bigger pyramid discovered in Bosnia.
Yeah.
It's aligned the same way.
I have a friend who actually grew up there, so he's pretty ecstatic.
Well, I'm really contemplating a trip there. If I go, I have to go before October of this year because, as many might know, Bosnia is near Sarajevo, which is like a ski capital of the world. So that whole place is going to be under about 3 yards of snow if I don't go before October. And if I wait till next spring, then it's going to interfere with my trip to the North Pole. So that means I have to make rather hasty plans. I really want to go. I think the archaeological dig is going to be just fascinating. And the fact that we've got, you know, very innovative, open-minded, and experienced archaeologists on the site doing the dig, they're not trying any longer to discredit it. They're 100% convinced it is a pyramid. It totally blows away the anthropology of that area. Anthropologists are still convinced that those people were just pounding seeds. You know, they were just hunter-gatherers. They had no such skills whatsoever. But the presence of that pyramid, the size of it, the scope of the complex, there are actually three pyramids in the complex, goes so far beyond what the primitives were doing at the time that they claim that was built. It's just phenomenal.
Brooks, I just pulled up because I wanted to look at it before I said it. I'm sure you'll let me plug something.
Sure.
There's an airline called AirTech, AirTech.com. I'm looking at its homepage right now. Anywhere in Europe is $219 one way from the United States.
Wow.
Yeah, they're the cheapest.
How many people do you have to put together to charter?
Oh, that's one ticket.
Oh, my goodness.
$219. The reason I know about them, the owner's name is Mike. He's always gotten me a ticket on just a few hours short notice. I live in Hawaii, as we know. And when I leave Los Angeles, he gets me for $139 on United Airlines a confirmed seat one way to Honolulu. He has got to be the cheapest there is.
AirTech, AirTech.
.com.
I have etched it on my tabletop.
So it's not that much there for you to go on a exploration.
I may have that exact amount in my wife's piggy bank. Might be able to master that. Well, if one could master this type of technology, then in the next 5 minutes, let's see if we can prime the next hour. What are the limits to travel in the universe if we could master this kind of technology?
Okay. I've been very lucky to have good critiquing of my work. Dennis Watts, he was the engineer in charge of communications for the International Space Station. You know, I guess I paraphrase and answer your questions by the endorsements of other people to make my work more palatable.
But anyway, he said that
my discovery makes us intergalactic, makes mankind intergalactic citizens. Essentially, what I've discovered is the propulsion source that can, I call it a reactionless drive. You can take any weight payload up into space. It's unaffected by whatever weight it's pulling. It is the secret of vertical lift takeoff. The propulsion system that I discovered, I gave it a crazy name. I call it the flux thruster atom pulsar. It cannot crash. There is no pitch or yaw. I believe when we were talking earlier, you mentioned how everything comes back to the gyroscope. Did you say that?
No, I didn't. I just I kind of felt like it was a Mobius strip, or instead of being an infinite straight line, it's more like an infinite circle.
Well, everything is based on the axis, A-X-I-S, the axis, the gyroscope. As we know, when we spin a gyroscope, it'll stand up by itself, come to center, correct?
Correct.
Same as the universe, same as solar systems, planets. What I've discovered is how to create an engine. I guess it's kind of just like contact, those huge gyroscopes.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, I've discovered, well, again, they said I discovered the source of the non-decaying spin of the electron. I know how to make a coil that is not just an electrical coil, but it's a field generator coil. And I'm able to create the energy can spin so fast in my coil, it's solid state. It's solid state. There's no moving parts but the subatomic energy itself. And I'm able to make this energy spin so that it creates an electrical venturi. It creates a localized space-time implosion. Essentially, I can make a man-made black hole, an artificial singular laboratory desktop workbench. Can you hold just one sec? I'm going to tell my wife to come and get the kids.
Oh, yeah, that'll be just fine. I don't know if our listeners know, but a black hole is a point at which the gravitational pull is so powerful that light or any kind of radiation cannot escape.
I'm back. Can't get the kids. I guess I got them.
I was just explaining to the listeners the characteristics of a black hole. We kind of toss that term around indiscriminately sometimes, especially when we talk about memories. But it's a point at which, you know, gravity is so powerful that light or any radiation can escape it. But it has a remarkable effect, at least mathematically speaking, on space-time. It has a tendency to warp it, and at least in classic treatments of the idea, we haven't directly observed one, but we theorize that they do exist, and we theorize what their effects are on the universe. So the idea of creating a black hole in a laboratory, of course, it's been tried. They have the heavy ion collider. But that's kind of where we slam gold ions together at high speed, and the resulting energy is such that it creates a gamma compression, you know, way up in the giga electron volts. But the existence of the black hole is analogous. That is to say, they get a fireball, and mathematically the fireball matches all of the earmarks of a black hole, and so they... just because of the detection itself, say that we've created a black hole, but they really haven't. And even if they have, it's only a microsecond. What Marco is talking about is creating a black hole and sustaining it.
That's right. I mean, the whole sustaining is the key aspect.
Sure.
It's called a non-incinerating, self-sustaining. the nature... The black holes that exist in the solar system throughout the universe are black holes that are transforming energy to maintain their existence, not what we do in a laboratory, which is essentially annihilation.
Right. Well, we've got about 20 seconds left in this hour. We will hold that thought. I don't want you to go anywhere, because we are going to get into the guts of a black hole and the mathematics thereof and the uniqueness of it.
I'm going to tear up the topic of black holes.
Well, this is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio. My excellent guest is Marco Rodin, and we are going to come right back after about 5 minutes of commercials.
One of the things we observe here at X-Squared Radio is that many listeners to this program are educators. Well, we have recently added a great affiliate for you. The Academic Superstore is the place where you can buy software, neat tools and gadgets, and even supplies such as calculators and iPod peripherals at huge discounts. The best things for the classroom and for the student are just a tax-free click away. All you have to do is click the Academic Superstore sign at X Squared Radio and start saving. The space shuttle fleet is very soon going to be retired. No other spacecraft in history has advanced the world more than this fleet. I wanted a way to keep that memory alive in my home, so I went to the space store and ordered a 25-inch model of the Space Orbiter. People who have seen it always comment on the incredible attention to detail in this model. If you know someone who loves the space program, and you want to get them a gift that they will never forget, you should visit the space store at X Squared Radio.
That's what I'm going to do.
You probably know Kevin Smith as one of the premier talk radio hosts in the world today. Well, now there is a new reason to know the name. His new book, Gods in the Garden. It's a shining light of truth in print that takes us back to the origins of mankind. Don't be afraid to find out who you really are and where you came from. The answer will open the windows of knowledge for you, so you can see everything for yourself. Visit his website at kevinsmithshow.com or purchase it at the online store at X Squared Radio today. People are always looking for something inexpensive and unique to give people they love. Well, now there is a way to give a gift that not only says how long you will love them, but it also allows you to help keep the planet green and growing. Tree Givers at X Squared Radio is the company that will plant a tree on public lands somewhere in the 50 states and provide your special person with a beautiful certificate of that placement. This has become one of the most popular gift sites in the world. And because of their love for the earth, they are changing the world. So visit Tree Givers at X Squared Radio and see if you can find a gift for your special person.
Sure, baby, sure.
Have you ever thought about owning a telescope? I mean, a really good telescope. Well, at the Discovery Store, you can find the world's best telescopes at great discounts and free shipping. They have come a long way, you know. Most of the comets discovered in the last 50 years were found by amateurs. There is no better way to view the sun than with a coronoscope. Trust me, you will be captivated if you ever get to watch the sun through one of these units. Who knows? You might just save the planet. So plan a trip to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. This is where the past meets the future. My guest tonight is Marco Roden. I hope you're enjoying the discussion. We're about to get off into the mud of math and physics, talking about black holes. There is an instrument called the Relativistic Heavy Ion Collider. We talked about it a little bit in the last hour. In this unit, the idea is to slam particles into one another and see what happens. The quantum gravity that's released inside
has resulted in single and dual black holes that collapse in on themselves. One recent experiment resulted in a fireball, as described in Haratiu Nastasi's paper at Brown University. Now, this is on a Planck scale, so you need to understand this is extremely small, and it exists only in flat space, kind of like a membrane. We call them brains in physics. The energy from colliding gold ions is about 100 giga electron volts per nucleon, which Nastase claims is an analog to a black hole. Yes, the energy seems to be sufficient, but I personally am looking for something more functional than mathematical analogs to black holes. Now, some are trying to accomplish this with electromagnetic coils. And the coils, they have to be super colliders. All kinds of different superconducting magnets are employed. We've used omega lasers. We've tried all kinds of things to create this kind of perfect compression. And we're familiar with these types of magnets. They work like solenoids in our cars, like power door locks or the starter drive. But Marco Rodin's coil has a different design. And I want him to just take a few minutes and explain to us what makes the Rodin coil so different than others.
Well, there's three things. And one of those three things is duplicated twice. So you could say two things, but one of them is twice. The first is I've discovered what's called the longest mean free pathway of least resistance, which is the conductor or the pathway that the electricity follows without having random collisions, parasitics. In other words, how to get rid of resistance, the least amount of friction.
Right. Electrons colliding into one another annihilate each other or hinder each other, cancel each other out. So first of all, you get heat in the wire for one thing, and the other is you get less output than you have input.
Mm-hmm. The principle of electricity as well is it isn't even a single conductor. They come in pairs. And the energy flows in opposite directions to one another. And then the next crucial feature of it is that there must be a space in between the two conductors. And this space is not empty. There's a magnetic field in there. And in the center of the magnetic field, there is what I call either an inertia ether, an ether on flux, spirit, monopole, whatever you want to call it. There's an energy that's never been seen before that always occurs at the center of magnetism. Only magnetism can respond quick enough to give an instantaneous, to give slippage and free play to this emanation, this flux, which goes in the opposite direction of the magnetic field. And the ensuing result is you get what is called underpinning nested vortices. Penrose referred to them as sunspots. And these underpinning nested vortices are the foremost significant controlling influence over electricity and energy. It controls the motion, the natural insulation properties, by insulation, it creates a harmonic shear. It literally creates a perfect, ideal, solid state, non-physical as far as it's subatomic particles moving on the third dimension. It's the ultimate motor without any physical moving parts.
Hmm.
And the black hole, the ultimate shape, there's a flash, but I'm not going to take it. The ultimate shape is a nozzle. A black hole is a nozzle. Everything's a nozzle. It's functioning at its ultimate well-being. Everything's based on in and out. We eat, and we pass it out. Every black hole feeds a white hole. For every a black hole is sucking in, a white hole is shoving out. The difference is a white hole eventually curves and warps around and comes back in and feeds the black hole again.
I've been up to the Boston Museum of Science, and it's one of the better physics museums out there. They have the largest Van de Graaff generators in the world there. And they have a great electrical show where they really throw some exciting lightning bolts around for kids to watch. But one of the things that you'll notice when you go in there, in fact, just about any of the observatories or science museums that you go into will have a model. It looks like a tornado. It looks like the force lines of a tornado, or like a big funnel. But in every museum that I go into, they only have one half of the funnel up there in neon lights. And, you know, science enthusiasts and kids from all over the world see one half of the picture. And really, it's only, in my opinion, a fraction of the whole mathematical picture. I think what Marco's talking about here about a nozzle input and a nozzle output are two tornadoes put together at the small end. So you have an inlet and an outlet. And the force that it takes to push this shape into space-time is a black hole. Right?
That's right. For people are so familiar with... when they see a tornado, which comes after the root word toroid.
Oh, how about that? I never made the connection. There you go again.
Mm-hmm. For every implosion, you have an explosion. I wish, how could I make it easy for as an analogy for people to understand? Well, the best example is a bar magnet, I think. If you take a bar magnet, you'll see the North Pole as it comes in. As the North Pole goes in, it looks like a bird's nest. There's a hole through the center. Everything starts pinching. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Sure.
And as you look at the South Pole of the magnet, it's the same shape but mirrored.
Yeah, except the lines are coming out and expanding in all directions.
That's right. And it feeds the top. Well, I don't know if that was a good analogy.
Well, so if you put a bar magnet under, well, say a white piece of paper, and then you sprinkle filings on top of it, you know, the flux lines are invisible to us until you sprinkle iron filings on it. Then the iron filings sort of line themselves up with the flux lines, sort of like the bearded man toy that the kids have, and they have a little bar magnet that you can pull the magnetic filings around with. You can see the flux lines because the iron filings line up with them, and they look pretty organized, don't they?
Right. The mathematics I discovered completely explains when and where and how these higher dimensional flux fields occur, as well as when and how the electrical moment occurs, where the electricity has been and where it's going to go. And it all has a common foci and reference, which is the center, the hub, which is where the emanations that this mass can observe where they're coming from. Would you allow me to discuss a little bit for a second here cosmology, creation?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's one of my favorite subjects.
Okay.
Light it up.
A black hole always has connected to it a jet stream coming out the opposite end of it. A quasar goes billions of... what's the biggest quasar ever seen? Am I correct in saying one would go billions of light years across the solar system?
Yeah, I think so. We use quasars to age the universe. They are tremendous outputs of energy. It's like a big hula hoop with a light beam coming out of the center of it, because mass gets accelerated so fast that it ends up emanating light, which we can see, or that we can pick up with various telescopes.
But now, this energy isn't coming from nowhere.
No,
it has
it's not
to
coming
be,
from nowhere.
And my belief is that on the opposite side of the quasar is a black hole that's sucking it in.
I believe almost that very thing.
So what you have is you have it going in at one end, which is this black hole, the negative vortex, and coming out the other side, which is the positive vortex, the white hole. So what I do is I make coils that mirror this process. And I wind them in such a way and braid and weave my conductors in such a way that these quasars, these jet streams of plasma that are shooting through space, would be braided in the same way. Because I'm following a blueprint, a template, the ultimate schematic. Because I literally pieced all numbers together, all mathematics together, and found that they made the shape of this black hole, white hole, which is a toroid. And so you can literally reverse engineer and make this device and accomplish the same output. Now, my most poorly energized, crudest prototypes, I received certified results that I was getting essentially double the output, which was considered remarkable or even impossible.
So this is double the magnetic flow through the center of the hole of your coil.
Right.
With the same amount of electrical input than a standard coil.
Correct.
Wow.
They use the same forms with the same amount of copper, wound them one way based upon my design and the other way based upon a standard coil. And they call it the Roden coil. The coil with my design got so much more energy out that that a seasoned, mature engineer would say it's impossible.
Now, what did the, you know, we talked about iron filings earlier. What do the iron filings look like when placed above your coil?
It created quite a sensation. It was done independently of me by a private researcher named Jean-Louis Nodin, J-L-N, Jean-Louis, J-L-N, as in Nancy, Labs, L-A-B-S. He has his own laboratory in France, and he put the results online. I could even pull it up right now, and there's pictures. Have you ever seen them, Brooks?
Yeah, I have them printed out here, and the reason I asked you the question is the difference between a standard coil output and your coil output relative to just how iron filings behave around it is like the difference between a slinky and made of steel and a slinky made of feathers. There's so much more energy.
Feathering fractal pattern of the magnetic field shocked all the electrical engineers, I know.
Well, and it was more than that. There's like, it's like the flux lines are actually twisted.
That's right. You just made a man-made vortex, a solid-state Venturi effect, using nothing but the fields themselves.
Now, what happens if you jack the input power to this up high enough?
Well, here's the thing. I like to be very concise. And that particular coil, which redounds to my success and gives me so much credit, actually hardly, just barely comes close to the correct design of how it should be made. My position is that this principle that I've discovered is so powerful that even when you only marginally approach it, just barely approximate it, it still works. In other words, what I'm saying is we've almost just literally been stumbling around and we're doing good. Because the way that it's supposed to be made and to get the effect that I'm describing, it requires other aspects incorporated and other energization being turned on in a different way. But fortunately for me, it still did what they said was impossible. It still defied what they would have predicted to expect.
Now, what kind of, I haven't asked you this question, electrically speaking, when we run AC power through a coil, the higher the frequency is, the higher the impedance is through that coil. That's how we make filters and electrical filters to tune in radios, for instance, or to block out feedback from our alternator to our radio in our car. How do your coils behave electrically in the AC world compared to the DC world, or compared to standard coils? I mean, does the inductance formula still hold?
No.
Wow.
No. The conventional electrical engineering formulas, mathematics, are worthless, I'm sorry to say.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Maxwell postulated what he referred to as a monopole to symmetrize all his electrical equations.
Right.
You know, and I want to be fair. Certainly certain things can be refined and better understood in conventional understanding and still then may be reintroduced. But essentially, the discovery I made about mathematics is so contrary. I mean, to be very honest, I'm like a science fiction book. I'm like the outer limits of the Twilight Zone. I am
like
so far out there with what this discovery is. So, I mean, when you introduced me, you said, you know, Marco has discovered that numbers are real, that nature is expressing herself with numbers. I have found the missing link, the one-to-one correspondence between numbers and physical reality. I've discovered that numbers don't move, that numbers are stationary vector interstices that are created by a positive emanation that I still refer to by as spirit, that this emanation is irresistible. It's the source of all motion, time, and vibration, penetrates everything, and leaves this number reticulation pattern in everything. I found that numbers are a legend, a blueprint, a schematic to reality, that we literally can have literally God's workbench where we can engineer anything. Because I've combined every function, every formula, every known calculation in mathematics together into a single toroid, into a single donut, into a single model, and I'm as blown away by anyone else when I, too, had to learn that this model is a coil. This is a coil that you can literally, and when I realized that coils are pervasive through the very pillar of our society, TVs, cars, anything doesn't exist without a coil, period. Our whole technology is the backbone of it. And who would have dreamt in the wildest flight of fancy that numbers are a coil too? The trick was when I discovered to separate the 396693, that was not a physical part of the coil, that was a higher dimensional flux field, that only the numbers 124875 is a physical coil, is it properly understood. But when you separate the decimal system into two separate systems, that one part is the coil and the other is the field, that the 396 is a separate, helically woven together, higher dimensional system. Then you get rid of mathematical enigmas. Then you can calculate things in a whole new fashion. I got a little bit on a roll there.
No, that's all right. That's all right. I'm seeing now how your mathematical theory works in the design of the coils. Well, one of the things that maybe our listeners don't know is that when you charge up a coil with a DC field, for instance, you connect the coil in your car to a 12-volt battery, it creates a magnetic field. That coil is now an electromagnet. As soon as you pull the power off, that magnetic field has to go somewhere. What happens is it collapses and inductively creates a voltage. That's how your car runs. The coil is charged up by either a capacitor or your battery, and when the connection is broken, the magnetic field collapses, which creates about a 45,000-volt spark, which jumps a gap between the anode and cathode in your on your spark plug inside your combustion chamber and lights up the fuel-air mixture that you just pulled in with the intake stroke of your engine. That's how a coil works. What I was going to ask Marco is, what does, since you're getting so much more output with this winding of coil, what does the voltage do when a when a Roden magnetic field collapses?
Okay. Now, here I am speaking to the audience, and tests have been made. Hewlett Packard Materials Testing Division tested the coils. I'm going to be putting up online a lot of the earlier test results and pictures of the coils energized. I'm going to put it up on, if I ever get around to it. I've been trying to do it for the last month, and I haven't done it, but hopefully in the near future. I'm going to put it up at www.rodinproject.com, rodinproject.com. And so while there has been test results, while people have made hardware out of it, and that's what I'm going to be sharing, the tests, and I could discuss that more. Simply put, that's still to be done. I have not had the money, I have not had the resources, I have not had the equipment or staff to do hardly anything. My life is I'm pretty much I'm in survival mode month to month. You know, I won't.
Yeah, well, I understand that. I understand that exactly. Most great minds are impoverished until things click. But you know, if we can generate 40,000 volts with a coil, you know, a third the size, you've not only reduced the amount of weight, but the amount of energy required to create all kinds of things.
Right. Yeah.
Well, not only that.
On our first prototype, we had a 20% for the reduction in copper.
That's phenomenal. At $2.05 a pound, that's a phenomenal savings.
That's the tip of the iceberg. Essentially, what I'm doing with these coils is, as you saw by the huge magnetic spiral arm, is I have figured out an important part of these coils. As you look at them, you see that one third of it is a big space. That it's, and what I found is that I found that the secret of the relationship of the magnetic field to the electrical windings is I actually use its own flux field to literally bathe and cool and can keep down the temperature of the coil. I found that the relationship of magnetism to electricity is that of a refrigeration system, of a coolant system. Do you follow me?
Yeah, I know how that works.
Well, that's what a black hole is doing. That's why a quasar is being fed by a black hole, because a black hole and the quasar, which are the same, would incinerate if it didn't suck in all those stars and other planets at one end and eject them out the other. It's literally bathing itself in planets and stars, and it's using them and its own, the field, that ensuing field that it creates, to maintain a constant temperature, a fixed temperature, that it can't go above or exceed that temperature, or it will self-destruct and incinerate. You were talking earlier together with me when we were discussing how to sustain a black hole. And it does it by using, as its coolant system, the either electricity creating the field, or in this case of a black hole, stars and planets, and literally sucking in galaxies, that it bathes itself and then shoots them out in a quasar. Where does it go? Far out into the universe, into the outer ergosphere, it's called, the distant ambient environment, where then this matter cools down, dissipates its heat, eventually amalgamates again, forms more planets and stars, only to be sucked in again at the other side, in a black hole again, literally trillions and trillions of years, after it's given off all its heat, to repeat the cycle as an endless system of renewal, of refrigeration.
Sounds just like the air conditioning system in your car.
It's the best analogy. If you want to give an analogy of a closed system that recycles, takes the energy, the heat away from the core, because that's what a black hole, that's what a coil does. And the biggest expense in computers, in the biggest problem with circuitry today is excess heat,
sure.
Even with processors and computers. The destructive degradation from temperature. And so what I've discovered is I figured out that energy, electricity itself, has an inherent built-in system built into it, how it can maintain its own constant temperature so that it can survive. So when I design my coils, the reason they work and the reason you get such a greater magnetic output is because it is a coherent encompassing relationship of all the different energies, from electricity to the magnetic field to the flux that's at the center of the field.
All this is fascinating to me because I know a little bit about electronics, and I think we've not lost all the listeners, and we're trying not to go too deep into the theory, but I'm trying to relate it to equipment that they're familiar with. I do want to open the phone lines a little bit early instead of doing it at the top of the hour. So if you want to call in, you've got some technical questions, or we've lost you somehow, and you need an answer, you can call in toll-free anywhere on the planet, 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. One of the things when we talk about early physics, Newtonian, Newton had an idea of a thing called ether. In fact, he had a thing called the ether project or ether profile. And he, to make a long story short, thought that it was the fabric or the filler of the universe. And one of the things that the Roden coil does is it vortexes the ether of energy. And I was going to ask you, why do you think this is key to the function of the coil? And
well,
you just answered me by saying that it's the cooling system.
Go ahead.
You said that the processing of matter in it gets hot, it goes out, it cools off, it comes back in and gathers, absorbs more energy. So it's a self-cooling, closed system. But what else are we looking at here? Because it sounds to me like you've got the workings of a propulsion system.
Sure, that's exactly what I have, is a propulsion system. I actually was selected by the military, by Defense Science Magazine, which is the biggest military publication in the United States, by the editor, James Martin. And they said I had the most revolutionary propulsion system ever created. And I was their guest speaker under Power and Propulsion Systems at Aerospace America, which was the biggest aerospace convention in the history of the United States. It was in San Diego. And I spoke at the Town and Country Hotel. George Bush Sr. was the maitre d' of honors. And I spoke to an audience. There was about 40 nuclear scientists present, if not more. What else happened there?
Well,
Keith Watson, he was in charge of the Bikini Atoll detonations. Was kind enough to introduce me and explain my work. He introduced me by starting off by saying, ask yourself whether or not, don't ask yourself whether or not Marco is crazy. Ask yourself whether or not he's crazy enough to be right. the ether, every house has a builder. Every structure has an invisible hand behind it. And the ether is always in our by all of our ancestors since all the way back to proverbial times has always been conjectured to exist. The ether was considered, even our radio broadcasts in the early 1900s were said this station is broadcasting to you over the ether wave.
Mm-hmm.
They defined the ether during those days as being a fluid of space, kind of like a static, loquacious jello, through which it was a medium that everything was transmitted. Then came the Michelson-Morley, I think it was, experiment in the early 1900s, It was in relationship to Einstein and relativity, I think, also that it was done.
Yeah.
They were looking for
it. Wrong.
Hmm?
I think it was done wrong, too. I think they came to the wrong conclusion. Michelson-Morley made an interferometer to see if the speed of light was affected by the motion of Earth through the ether.
I'm glad you're explaining it clearer because, you know, I just repeat what I hear, and that's the first time I didn't know that they actually used that type of an interferometer.
Yeah, that's why it was designed. In fact, that design has been capitalized upon by Kip Thorne and his team to build the laser interferometer gravitational wave observatories, and they're now using those to, well, they're down to about...
And I sense in your voice a little disdain.
It's not that. It's that they still treat...
Well, you're feeling that it's obsolete is what you're... It sounds like you're saying.
They still feel that space is flat, and they really believe it's the sapphire molecules on the mirror that are ringing when gravitational wave comes through, and my theory is that it's actually the pathway of the laser beams that's bending, and that's why they get the interferometric signal, but... if you're not affiliated with a major university, they're really not interested in listening, but that doesn't mean that they're any more right than I think they are.
Well, Brooks, did you ever hear this? What was alluded to by Einstein's response to the results of that experiment? Did you ever hear what they said Einstein's conclusion was?
I think he felt vindicated because he had always claimed that the speed of light was constant because it was time itself that was moving and not the actual velocity of light.
Okay. One of the things that I heard that was attributed to him as saying was that the only other conclusion that the experiment could result in would be if there was no ether, there could only be one other answer. Do you know what that was?
No, what was that?
He said the only other answer, there was only one other possibility option, if it does exist at all, that it could be, and that is an inertia ether.
Oh, yes, yes, that's correct. Resistance to movement.
And that's what this is. That's why I refer to it as spirit, because it's simply put, all it is to me, and remember, I'm not well-educated, you are. But to me, all it is positive emanation. So and that's what this math can model. It shows that there's a positive emanation over the surface of the torus. It reveals a surface topology. It shows then what numbers are negative and that they're negative draft counter space. But what the beauty of this math is that it shows the z-axis. I hate to fall back on my laurels, but Russell Blake, there's a website, rodinmath.com, and in it, halfway, just the beginning of the page, is an executive summary. It's called the Rodin Solution Project, something like that, an executive summary. It's a PDF, and halfway through that PDF, about 60 pages in, is a mathematical treatment by Russell Blake from Microsoft. Senior researcher of Microsoft, author of the book Optimizing Windows NT for Microsoft Press. He's very well known in the computing world. And he said he did a total mathematical treatment on my work. He called it and that paper is published in that article, in that PDF. It's called The Mathematical Formulation of the Rodin Torus. He says that what I've done is not possible by modern mathematics. He says it's been completely overlooked. He says only this math models the interior volume of the torus into 3D space, and he says in that article that it proves that this mathematics can observe four dimension and higher. And so what I'm saying is that when you bring up the ether, wholeheartedly, completely, with all my being, do I endorse the existence of not a static loquacious ether, but an inertia ether, an ether that is a vector, it's a velocity, it gives a preferred frame of reference to everything, it gives spatial orientation to everything, up, down, right, left, front, back. It's what defines and controls and creates the black hole vortex. Okay? The unique thing about this inertia ether, and it has one profound, significant quality is that it moves in a straight line. It is linear. It does not bend. And that's why everything that we see in the physical world is precessing, is warping, is curving. It is, everything has to have something to wrap around. And the ether is the spindle that is causing all matter, all mass, the curvature of the universe, to move and wrap around. But it is an emanating, positive emanation, irresistible, linear, beyond the known elements particle.
Is this what you call the mathematical fingerprint of God?
The mathematical fingerprint of God is there is a PDF on the front of my webpage. And you see the infinity, the doubling circuit, and you see this vector, this emanation, where the 3 and the 6 both connect at the 9, but they don't connect with each other. And at the center of that infinity, under the 9, where infinity's epicenter is there's like a sun, a star, where this inertia ether emanates from. And that symbol, which I decrypted from the most great name of God out of the Baha'i faith, is the mathematical fingerprint of God. That is literally God's striations, God's interferometry pattern, God's diffraction grating. Because literally, I've done what they tried to do, what we've discussed with the interferometry pattern. I have done it with discrete numbers. I've pieced every discrete number together where it can do every advanced mathematical calculation. I remember I put an algebraic teacher into shock when I showed him that I could do algebraic functions with discrete numbers. That's how Russell Blake was able to write the article on my work, because I found a way to replace all algebraic symbols with discrete numbers. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I'm giving every number, every discrete number has an XYZ axis relationship. Do you follow that?
Yes.
That's never been done before. I've literally broken the key. I've literally cracked the code now that's available to mankind for anyone to pursue the treasure trove of divine arithmetic, of true mathematics.
Well, do you think, and this is going to be an easy question for you to answer, do you think this has anything to do with the creative powers of God?
It reveals how God created the universe.
It shows
that creation is mechanical. It shows that it does not have a self sustaining existence, but that rather it has a dependent and it is reliant upon, I call it point energy creation physics, because I'm able to show everything is beginning and returning. The beginning and end and the origin are one and the same, which is a point. I call it the primal point. So, yes, I have found the secret of creation. I have found how God's how he performs his handiwork. God's creation is mechanical. There is an agency, there is a modality to how he does it. Now, don't ever assume, though, that I'm saying that I have begun to ascribe to God anything. Rather, I can only define my world of creation, the contingent world. Out of caution and regard to God, I'm the first one to confess that he's omnipotent, untrammeled, the uncreated. But our world, the world of being, I have unraveled and exposed and made available to everybody the secret of how God did it. Of course, I have so much more pages to show to put up online. I literally have, I don't know, if I had the money, I'd hire a flash, macromedia flash webpage designer. and then I could do a very good detailed explanation. The biggest reason I've been not put up most of my papers is because they're just so overwhelming and difficult to understand, the mathematics. Although they're clear, they just need to be explained and if they were explained with animation, it would be much easier.
Oh, sure. When you explain things with animation, they become a lot easier. So now you have discovered the fingerprint of God. You've got this primal origin point. You've got an understanding of how to actually twist magnetic fields and really turn the entire electrical engineering world on its ear. And it seems as though you've got a source from which you draw this information. I'm going to ask you a question about numerology. Has numerology played into the creation of Rodin mathematics?
Well, Rodin mathematics deals with the electrical, the magnetic, the spirit or flux field property to numbers. It looks at number patterns and it shows their relationships as Rodin mathematics models what's called the underpinning geometry of the universe. It models how energy moves through space. It explains what zero is and where zero, and that zero never is. On the other hand, classical numerology is typically related to psychological personality, mental profiles. I am not, that has not been my endeavor. When I look at my work smacking of numerology, when I look and see that the 3, 9, and 6 is invisible, that it's a higher dimensional flux field, and I feel that my credibility is waning because I'm saying that 3 and 6 represent the magnetic property, it causes me a certain amount of injury, because for anyone to be ascribing an attribute or quality to numbers dealing with a principle of existence is very far afield, and it's just outlandish in appearance. But 3 and 6 are the numbers that represent the magnetic field, and 3 and 6 are the numbers for perfect oscillation, perfect opposals. It's the yin and yang. 3 double to 6, 6 double to 12, 1 plus 2 is 3. 12 double to 24 is 6. 24 double to 48 is 12 is 3. 48 double to 96 equals 15 equals 6. 3 and 6 can never be anything else but either 3 or 6.
Mm-hmm.
They are the classic duality of opposals, of oscillating back and forth, one or the other, and nothing else ever in between. Do you follow me?
Yes.
But 3 and 6 never come alone, and they never touch each other. They always have 9 in the center. And when you see the mathematical fingerprint of God on my website, and you see how 3 and 6 connect at 9, because they are a vector representing that energy, the inertia ether, that spirit shooting out, and that 3, the beauty of it is that I can tell you what number 3 and 6 is positive or minus and when in relationship to 9, and how they phase and pulse in synchronization together. But that is mathematics and isn't easily done on the phone.
Well, you know, most people have a hard time with three dimensions, and I've heard you allude to it a couple of times tonight. How many dimensions does one need to master to understand the theory of Rodin math?
Again, to set myself up to look foolish, I don't believe that there's any dimensions higher after the third than one other dimension. But that dimension is two dimensions that are coupled, because above the third is the fourth dimension, which is a magnetic field. But the magnetic field is the only thing that responds fast enough simultaneously with the flux of spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Spirit and magnetism always come together. In the center of electricity, you have magnetism. In the center, in the coil, in the center of magnetism, you have spirit. And this spirit is unique in that it travels in a straight line. That's why our curvature, everything worships God irregardless to the, of its reality. On the physical, material world, we worship the axis, the hub, the center of the earth. Everything's pointing to it. All matter always has a foci. Do you follow me?
Mm-hmm.
Just like the earth revolves around the sun. It's an, everything worships, whether it is aware of it or not. On the higher dimensional world of the omni-fourth dimension, omnidirectional is linear. It emanates in every direction. I call it the dandelion puff principle. Spirit is omnidirectional, emanates in thirds in all directions, omni. The best analogy to an omni would be a queen on a chessboard in the center. She can go up, down, right, left, front, back, any way she wants to go. That's omnidirectional. Do you follow
mm-hmm.
me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's what spirit does. That's why everything makes a toroid and warps and curves back into the center, because of that emanation from the center omnidirectionally. But the fourth dimension always, which is, omni is the fifth dimension, but the fourth is always coupled with the fifth, and that's the only dimension, the omni fourth, I call the fifth omni. The omni fourth is the only dimension above the third dimension, because after omni, going in a straight line, there is nothing higher. And to me, I define a dimension, all a dimension is to Marco, is how matter moves through space.
Sure. Sure. Well, let me ask you this question then. Can you support the idea that Earth, or at least part of it, originated in the fourth dimension and may yet return to it?
They're inseparable. And there is no dimension without all of the other dimensions.
Right.
And they're all dependent on the omni. On their, our existence is constantly because of these emanations. It's because of the spirit. If the pulsing of this spirit, when I make my coils, when I wind the rotating coil, when it's energized, I'm able to make electricity follow these doubling circuits, these conductors, at a speed that can't be done by any other coil, without friction and resistance compared to any other coil. And the reason I do that is because the electrical moment is intersecting, it's imperfect phasing to that inertia ether, to that spirit. I take that winding and I have every other 50% of that winding, because bear in mind, 50%, because I tile the torus, as you've seen, 50% is positive tiles, the other 50% is negative tiles, correct?
Right.
And each winding is energized. When it's energized, all the positive tiles are energized simultaneously. I make such a ratchet that is so gripping and unretractable. That's what a toroid is. A toroid is like a blender. What are those hand cranks that you turn when you used to grind sugar cane or pull something into it?
Mm-hmm.
That's called a what? A grater, I guess? That's what a toroid is. That's what a black hole is. I call it a witch's cauldron melting pot, because it takes every atom and stirs it together and blends them like a mixing pot. That's how it purifies planets. That's how it takes plutonium and makes it into nothing. The most deadly substance known to man is not botulism, it's plutonium. And
right.
A black hole makes plutonium, you know, nothing. Gaseous matter. Totally purifies it, eliminates the dangers. All of our bodies, the human bodies, are all made out of countless stars of the past. We're all made out of stardust, because every one of our bodies has come from a quasar, from a hot stellar gaseous plume of matter, eventually amalgamating and forming other planets, and we happen to be alive on this one. Okay, but our body was mixed together and pulverized with endless suns and stars and planets, that it gave off all their heat and were sucked into a black hole. Eventually the Earth is going to have its seas boil off in its beds. Eventually the Earth's mountains are going to be pulled, crushing flat. And we're going to be mixed and blended together with other planets and stars that are nothing but waste, cinders, and churned and blended together in this cauldron, which is a vortex. And this is all driven by the emanations. So when I make this winding, this coil, I phase the emanation so perfectly, and it's based on a harmonic of thirds, that electricity, that winding is energized every single positive tile evenly, 50% of that winding, that the whole thing works in unison. like a perfect gear. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so you have nothing but constructive interference.
Correct.
In electricity or in music, for that matter, when we add lower amplitude signals, as long as they are harmonized with one another or even overlay one another perfectly, they constructively interfere with one another. That is to say, they add to the power. But if you are out of phase, not only does it sound bad, but it takes away from the power of the signal. This is the way noise cancellation headphones work. They have a little microphone on the outside of the headphone. They pick up the noise, whether it's a jetliner or your car or whatever, and they create a signal 100 or 90 degrees out of that signal and feed it right back into the very speakers that are feeding you the music, and it cancels out all the exterior noise by destructively interfering with that sound. It sounds like what you've done is you've perfectly synchronized all of the electrons, all of the positive movements, so that they constructively interfere with one another, creating a much more amplified and syncopated move.
Now, Brooks, I call this synchronized electricity, and I'm going to assign some homework, if you'll allow me, for you.
I like homework.
Okay. On my website, you'll find somewhere a toroid with numbers with tiles, correct?
Is this the Roden sunflower map?
Yeah.
I've got it.
Okay. What you've just described, who would ever think that numbers, that the mathematics, that you could piece every single number together and it would reveal that syncopation? I call it harmonic cascadence. Are you ready for the most beautiful testimonial, the most eloquent proof of it?
Take
any number on that skin. You follow what I'm saying? Take any tile.
Okay.
You add up all the tiles around it. You're a physicist. You're familiar with the principle of communicated agitation in Newton's cradle.
Yes.
In other words, you take two balls, two will shoot out the other end. You take one ball, one will come out the other end.
Mm-hmm.
You follow the principle?
Right.
You will be making any waves of nine rings that will equal the number in the center, because just based on if you throw a pebble in the water, it'll make waves, but the sum total is the origin, is the center. Where the do you follow what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Take any number on that toroid skin, add all the numbers around it, and it will always equal the number in the center. It never loses its value. The reason my mathematics works is I piece numbers together. They're like leaves floating on the water. Each one is transmitting waves, vibration, through the other ones. But none of them are moving in relationship to themselves.
Yeah, they're all stationary.
That's right. That's why I refer to numbers as stationary vector interstices, based on this positive emanation that's created them.
So
pick a number. What number do you have?
I picked five.
Okay, and what are the eight numbers around it?
Let's see. The eight numbers around it are 1, 2, 4, 7, 2, 1, 5, and 1.
Which equals 9. And what's 9 plus 5? Equals 14 is 5. It equals the center source.
Wow.
Do you see that it equals 9?
I do.
Okay.
So take
the next ring. How many? That was 8 numbers. The next amount of rings around it, I forget. I think it'll be 5 by 5.
Let's see. I can't count. This map is quite complex.
If you add up all those numbers, that next ring and the concentric circles, rings going on us on all the way outwards,
mm-hmm.
it will always equal the 5. And you could have picked any number.
So it's the function that moves, not the numbers.
That's right. Now, you've said it, and I think you understand it concisely and clearly. I don't know anybody that can comprehend that. Numbers don't move. The functions, the calculations move.
In algebra, we have a system of dealing with functions called piecewise functions. And like, just to give you a quick example, when you step on the gas in your car now, you're not really stepping on the gas. You're stepping on a potentiometer that's changing a value in a fuel management system. And based on the speed of the car, the load of the car, and all these algorithms that are coming into it, it decides how much fuel it's going to mix and optimize your fuel mileage and your power. That is a piecewise function. You are saying that if n equals 1, then you perform this function. If n equals 4 or up to 11, then you perform this function. And that's how it keeps the fuel-air mixture where you have the optimum power with the best fuel mileage. And they've even tied it into your transmission now. Modern cars don't, when you hit second gear, they don't burn the tires in the back. The engine scales back in torque. It makes the shift in the transmission, and then the engine automatically applies the torque again. All this is done with piecewise functions. And so what I think Marco is describing here with this, and you really need to go to his website. You can either go to rodinmath.com or rodinaerodynamics.com or rodinprojects.com, and you can probably link up to this Rodin's toroid sunflower map, and you can try this for yourself. But what he has drawn here is a geometrically perfect diagram of a piecewise function that corrects itself always back to the number 5.
The template never changes. I have found the archetypal template of creation. So that's why I can do anything. I can model, manufacture, produce anything out of the same template.
Now there's a gap between these windings. There are areas where there are no numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Does that line up with the areas of your coil that have no wire?
Do you know what numbers would have been in that space where the gap space is?
Well, I'm cheating. I have the answer. But it has to be 39669, repeating. Yeah.
396693, exactly.
Yeah.
God, I'm not going to try and explain, and it just wouldn't do anyone a service. But the nature of 396 and then it's flipping and then turning into 693, the fact that only 6 can touch 6 or only 3 can touch 3, but 3... I mean, one of the profound conclusions of this is that 3 and 6 can never touch. But it's too ambiguous to try and explain.
Well, I understand that they are the magnetic field.
Correct.
And so in order for it to exist and flow, they can't touch each other. They cancel each other out. Now, I'm going to have to break for commercials. We ran just a little bit long. If you'll allow me just to take 5 minutes, we will come back for our final hour, and we're going to get more into what the use of black holes could be, why we're even interested in them, and why we've got such a magnificent resource on the air tonight, and if there's anyone listening that has the resources to fund any of Marco's work, you could certainly get a hold of him. But we will take a...
Brooks, I couldn't have asked for a better interview, and I want to also say that I do have a video. It's a 4-hour video, and I'll discuss that more when I come back.
We'll talk about that video and your book, and we'll make sure people can get to it. I'm Brooks Agnew. This is X Squared Radio, and we'll be back in about 5 minutes and 20 seconds.
Mr. Professor, what's happening with you? Caller, he wants another bottle.
You own an inkjet printer, right? I used to purchase my replacement inkjet cartridges at a national superstore that will remain unnamed. A few months ago, I replaced the color and black cartridges, and the cost was nearly $80. Well, no more. Now, I purchase all my inkjet cartridge and copier supplies from 123 Inkjets. Now I pay less than $15 per cartridge, and I got free shipping. Plus, every time I buy, I have a chance at winning a brand new printer. How cool is that? All you have to do is click on the 123 Inkjets banner at X Squared Radio, and you get exactly the same savings. Excellent printer supplies at super savings at 123 Inkjets. At X Squared Radio. You know we have revealed to you the ancient predictions that natural disasters are going to increase in power and frequency in these times. We might not always have the National Weather Service or the Emergency Broadcasting Service. So you might want to get your hands on some of the best weather reporting instruments around. Visit Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio and pick up something that might be useful. They also have the neatest gifts for your favorite people who like things for the outdoors or for their meditation garden. Check out Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio.
Well, there is some place you should visit before the end of the week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the six-part series is now available for pre-purchase at $5 off. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, but you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important video productions you will ever see. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and the Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysm? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in the series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. Welcome back, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, and this is where the past meets the future. My guest tonight is Marco Rodin. I know, I'm just positive, that you did not expect a mathematician to be so interesting, but I can tell you this is where the rubber meets the road, and although I can tell you from experience most physicists are not mathematicians, and although I think a lot of mathematicians would make it very well as physicists, it takes a team, people that can understand the use of numbers, the origin of numbers, and can actually be inspired by them and see the spirit of them. I know you didn't feel that way when you were taking algebra in school, but that's because you probably had a lousy teacher. If you're not inspired by the subject, it's pretty difficult to teach. I had a very gifted little Indian man when I was in college who breezed me through calculus, and I sat with my mouth open all four semesters and could have eaten more. I was very interested in it, but I wanted to build stuff, so I became an engineer and use physics in my work.
Marco has been very gracious in sharing a lot of his knowledge with us tonight, and he is in the tropical paradise of Hawaii tonight, and I guess it's still overcast there. Is it nighttime there yet?
Oh, I don't know how to break it to you, but it when you called me, it wasn't even afternoon. So
we have a caller. Would you like me to put a caller on?
Well, sure. Let's take
you got it.
Caller, you'll need to tell us your first name and from where you are calling.
The other guy was talking there.
Go ahead, caller. I need your first name and where you're calling from.
Okay, my name's Tom, and I'm calling from Appleton, Wisconsin.
Wonderful. What's your question?
Okay, just a brief comment first. Listening to you guys talk, I'm reminded of reading science fiction comic books as a kid, and when the master alien race came to Earth, you always referred to the Earth as the puny Earthlings, and I feel sort of like that in terms of listening to
puny Earthlings.
Okay, but my question for Mr. Roden would be, you know, this is a marvelous discussion. I'm getting glimpses here and there of what you guys are talking about. I wonder if Mr. Roden could give, like, practical applications of the coil. In other words, are these coils being used as in the sense of a transformer where you have two coils and you're using either a pulsating DC or a AC voltage current to charge the coil and then collapse the coil and induce a, energy into another coil? Or is it just a single coil that's being used, and then maybe just some basic applications of that?
Oh, great question.
Okay. Here you go, Tom.
Okay.
It's very normal for scientists who are learning my work and starting to apply it by making their own inventions to make what I consider a detour path that they'll go ahead and they'll try and apply it to things like time travel or time influence, and they'll use four Roden coils, or they'll do them, they'll stack them, they'll do all different things. The truth is, in my view, is that you can do everything with just one, and that you don't need multiple coils.
Okay.
When you ask what are the practical applications, I've put myself on a head-on collision course with society. My goal is to obsolete petroleum as a fuel source. My goal, I believe that I've accomplished that I can get rid of nuclear power.
Excellent.
What I'm able to do is I believe I'm able to create inexhaustible energy. The coils, classical coils require an outside power source. Power plants, utilities, they use dams, hydro, water turning a coil or a magnet. The coil is cut by the magnet, and that produces energy. My coils are being cut by spirit. So my goal is to obsolete where you're tethered to some other work wheel, some other flowing energy like a river for the paddle wheel. I'm tapping into the energy of the positive emanation of spirit. So sensible as it sounds, my goal was then to obsolete utility companies. My goal was to get rid of requiring to take a fuel source along with you, like rocketry, the space shuttle. They use a fuel that comes from Earth, and it's a combustion engine, which is very limited in its range. I create an engine that can go anywhere in the universe. It doesn't have to return back to its originating home. And And it can go wherever it wants to and have all the energy it needs.
May I interject a question at this point?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. Is it sort of like you charge the coil and then the coil feeds on itself?
I think what he's saying is instead of having to hook the coil to an external power source to charge up the coil, generates its own electricity.
Wow. Okay.
Let me say this. Jean-Louis Not In Sight, a website that's up online. Jean-Louis Not In is very well respected. His specialty is vertical lift, and he specializes in research in trying to prove the existence of what is called the B-field torsion effect.
You might want to
axiom spin fields, the missing energy in the universe. Were you saying something, Brooks?
Yeah, you might want to tell us what B-field is.
I'd better leave that up to you.
I can't explain it in a short amount of time, but basically, you're talking about changing magnetism into electricity and electricity back into magnetism. The B field has to do with gravity. Am I pretty close to that? You have an A field and a B field, and the B field is the magnetic field that's external to a molecule, and the A field is the magnetic field that's internal to a molecule.
The A field that you're, are you referring to the same Tom Bearden, the curl free? Have you ever read Tom's work when he describes what's called a curl free A vector potential?
I'm sure I haven't.
I'm somewhat familiar with that, with Bearden.
He gave me a very complimentary endorsement on my work, saying that I'd torn away from the B field its potential, which was the A curl free. I'll put that paper, I think that paper is on my PDF on rodenmap.com under my executive
summary.
Over here
on the table.
I have a point I'd like to make. Okay? When people make my coils, as in Jean-Louis Not In up in the site, they do an input and an output. They have a takeoff. You'll see leads coming away from the Roden coil.
Okay.
They work. They're happy with the results. In my schematics, those leads don't exist, though. I say that's incorrect. But they don't know any other way to make them and to energize them. Some people have made the Roden coil, and they've energized it using plasma tubes and Tesla coils, resonant coil, all different ways of doing it. But I claim that the secret of this coil is that it is a circuit. There is no input. There is no output of the windings. That it is a closed system, like a cyclotron or an accelerator.
Okay.
One of my goals, which I have not fulfilled, and again, if I had the resources, I'd hire some good web people and a flash person. I apologize for never being able to get off the ground with my work, really, and launching it successfully so it is presented well. So many people have presented their work well, and I'm not one of them. But I would do schematics. I would do blueprints on how to build these coils, how to energize them, everything about it. The quickest shortcut that I can think of, since I don't have the resources to hire people, is I'm buying next week a Sony HC3. It's a high definition camera, and I bought already some round. They're like for macrame or whatever. I'm using them as forms for toroids, and so I'm going to wind them and show how they're made, videotape it, and I'm going to try and put that up online.
Interesting.
I think that's the only way for me to share the information that's within my reach.
Mm-hmm.
That I'm capable of doing on my own.
In these magnetic fields, although they're invisible, we can. Well, there's a couple of ways we've tried to observe them. One is, as I described earlier in the broadcast, using iron filings, and you can sort of get a two-dimensional picture of a B field a torsion field where this magnetic field twists up on itself. But at best, it's two-dimensional. I mean, the filings will stack up on themselves a little bit, but...
Well,
really,
Brooks,
yeah.
As you're doing those filings, what it's denoting, interestingly, though, will be what are called boundary conditions, the world boundary lines. Do you follow what I'm saying? Because because there's a property of fluxes is where there's inversions and shears. Do you know what I'm thinking?
Right.
So that's why I use this math, because even using filings or anything else is not going to reveal how these boundary conditions work. The beauty of this math that I discovered on the toroid, the reason I'm able to create an ultimate man-made black hole, a rodent coil that works, that is not destructible, is because the nested vortices, this math shows me, are staggered. And it's the most important part about it to me is that on this toroid is that the underpinning nested vortices are staggered, that they're askew. I don't know if you've seen any of my blueprints or models, Brooks, that shows that.
No, I haven't. I see a couple of drawings in here where it almost looks like a wagon wheel in motion, and it's frozen in certain periods of time.
Oh, are they black and white?
Yeah, black
cross-section?
Right.
Where did you come across that picture?
I don't know.
Was it on my website?
Yeah, I printed it out.
But those are the underpinning nested vortices, probably, if it's the same drawing I'm thinking of, showing how they're staggered and how they all originate from the center, from the emanations coming out. The significance of the staggered underpinning nested vortices as opposed to... As a toroid, opposed to DNA in a spiral helix that our bodies are composed of in biology, is that the underpinning nested vortices in DNA line up. The world boundary conditions directly adjoin, such that is what controls mitosis, information encryption in DNA sister strand replication. In other words, all biology, the missing postulated by Rupert Sheldrake morphogenetic field or bioetheric template, can be modeled with this mathematics by observing within the major groove of DNA how these underpinning nested vortices, in this case, do line up.
And I noticed you don't have to plug DNA into any external power supply.
Yeah, interesting.
Perfectly put.
It's sort of...
Excuse me for one second.
Does that answer your question, caller?
Yes. It certainly has helped me to understand more of what's going on here, and I definitely appreciate the opportunity to, ask you guys. And I'd just like to thank you for your radio show there, too, Brooks. I just discovered it about a month or so ago, and...
I appreciate it that you've been listening to it a month. That's really great. I captured your question in my mind, and I was thinking about it, why we use transformers, or step down and step up voltage so that we can use them for various circuits, like we have voltage that comes down the line outside our street, and it's stepped down to 220, which goes into our house, and we use it. We sort of conserve the energy by going from 161 kilovolts down to 110 volts in our house. And that way we don't have to deal with the high voltage in our home. But I think what Marco's saying, and what would be so revolutionary, almost as revolutionary as Tesla's work himself, is that all you'd really have to do is have a coil for the voltage you wanted. You wouldn't have to step down from anything.
Uh-huh.
The only thing you'd really have to learn is how to go from magnetism to the electricity that you need for your circuit.
Uh-huh. Fascinating.
I have an inspiration. Brooks, may I?
Yeah.
Okay. Because of the fact that you're trained professionally in the field of physics, there is a standard principle that I have proven that I have solved. It would be the Heisenberg uncertainty principle.
My good friend Heisenberg. Okay, lay it on me.
Okay, to first state what it is, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle says that if you know the moment, the position of the electron in the present, the electron moment, You won't know it in the future, because in order to observe it, you've observed it under electron microscope with light that's invasive. You've affected what you're observing, and you've changed the future outcome. In other words, it says you cannot know the past, present, or future position simultaneously of the electron moment, correct?
Right. Well, it's a little more metaphysical than that. The observation effect does have a part in the philosophy, but Heisenberg basically said you can't tell the speed and location of any particle.
Okay. Perfect. You ready for this?
I'm ready.
I am able, and it was, why couldn't you do it? Because of the fact that the thing that you were observing it with was invasive,
that's
correct?
Right. You change it.
You change it. It's being affected.
Sure. You bombard it with electrons or photons or something in order to detect it.
All right.
What you
need is a response-only method. Of a stretch of a mind this is, what I have accomplished is I have found, because numbers are real, that nature is expressing herself with numbers, I'm able to determine past, present, and future simultaneously of the electron moment. I'm able to prove that the Heisenberg uncertainty principle is not true because I am doing it uninvasively. I am creating a mathematical interferometry. Does that make any sense?
Well, it's not that Heisenberg's principle is untrue. It's that at the time, and really even up until a few minutes ago, there has been no receive-only method of detecting a particle's position and speed. We always have to either throw laser electricity at it, or laser photons at it, or we have to throw electrons at it, or neutrons at it. Somehow we absorb its energy or change its path or change its value in order to detect it. And so we can only tell its position or its velocity, but we can't tell both. If you had a receive-only method, and it sounds like you're about to tell us you do, then you would refute Heisenberg's uncertainty principle.
There you go. Because I know which number is activated when and where, and I'm able to know the position of every number in relationship to every other number. Stereographically, dimensionally, omnipotently.
All right. So in mathematics, the ultimate chaos is an output we call fractals. We make art with it, but... It's called infinity. It's a number that's numberless. It's unpredictable. And actually, Einstein hated it so much he refused to include gravity in his quantum equations because he got infinity for an answer so many times. And every time you plug any value into the model, you always got infinity. And to him, that was chaos and couldn't be quantified. So actually what you're saying is that infinity is just infinite information, not zero information.
Right, so, because zero doesn't even exist. It's a number can't be created or destroyed. Zero is not on a number line. No number line begins or ends with zero. That's right.
So how do we tap into this infinite information?
Well, I'm trying to understand when you're, I mean, I'm always game to respond, but I like to understand the dilemma of what you're describing because I could tackle it.
Let's just take the number pi, for instance. Pi is a.
But is that the example for the infinite that you were describing? Because because pi is something I can easily address, but is that the same as what you're describing?
It'll serve the same purpose.
Okay.
In some cases, the denominator to Einstein's equations was so small that by the time you worked out the equation, the number was so large as to be infinity. So,
okay. Allow me then.
Okay.
Okay. I'm going to be profane. Okay.
not too profane.
Pi is bullshit. Okay. What happens is their understanding of mathematics, the fact is that people who try and take pi out to a further decimal are of the most greatest ignorance and man-made error that anybody could ever do. Should I continue?
I understand the reason behind pi. It helps us understand curved.
But the thing is that, see, what I discovered is the reasoning behind it is based on the fact that numbers are a rigid, the same increment between each number, they're a rigid rule. What I discovered is that numbers are a sliding rule, or they expand and contract, like over the, you see how I have the same numbers, but in different size tiles over the skin of the torus based mm-hmm. on the, it's based on the inverse square law. The farther out from the axis, the bigger the tiles expanded, correct?
Right.
If you take the circumference of a circle, okay, all the numbers are of the same distance incrementally. But if you then try and move in towards the axis of that circle, every number that's actually, because I have the one-to-one correspondence relationship between a number and geometry space, volumetric space, numbers have spatial volumetric properties, which has never been known before. So as you take each number and as you're going towards the axis, what do those, the spatial geometric, what do those tiles do? They shrink.
Smaller. Right.
That's right. So I'm able to, because nobody's ever calculates into pi the condensed matter physics component characteristic of it.
Well, again. Yeah, they have, but not in, from a vortex point of view. They've always done it from a, you know, flat space-time point of view. Pi is allows you to deal with curved surfaces, like a sphere or like a circle. If you're trying to tell the area of a circle, then you need to, you know, square the radius and multiply it times pi, because pi sort of takes into consideration an infinite number of straight lines all the way around that circle. So you have an infinite number of triangles that form the surface of this circle. But when you're doing it with vortex, with a vortex, you can actually curve a line, which you can't do in Euclidean geometry. I think that's the beauty of your system, is that your tiles are not.
Brooks, do you want to know what the hardest part in the earlier stages of my discovery was, as far as solution, figuring out the solution for?
What?
The hardest part was trying to figure out the inside diameter of the torus of the vortex.
Wow.
What the correct size of that hole was. And it turned out that it was self-denoting. It took a long time to figure it out, and that it had a quantum relationship.
Hmm. Yeah, I was wondering how you figured out the interior diameter of your donut hole.
Well, it has to do with pi. It has to do with what that log is as you approach the vortex hole. Now, when you and I both are describing a vortex, the key component of a vortex is that you have nothing in the center, that you have a hole.
Yeah, correct.
That's called a tube. It's called a well. And just because I like to point out to our the correlation to our vocabulary and our language, a well means, are you well? And same as a funnel is the word, are you having fun? So a vortex deals with this hole through the center, which is a funnel or a well, which is critical for its well-being and survival. If you have anything occluding or blocking this hole, the system has logjam, blocks up, and shuts down.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Nothing, the reason I bring this up in relationship to our conversation of pi, is nothing ever, including pi, can come through the center of the circle, because the hole is denoted by the aperture, the lip, as you go around the hole. Even in a black hole out in the solar system at the center of the Milky Way, nothing is going through the center. Everything goes into a black hole and around the lip of the hole. Once the hole is filled up, the black hole ceases to exist. It is as things move around the lip that they define by being an aperture, by being a orifice, that they define then mathematically the existence of zero. But zero is not a number. It does not exist. And numbers never can begin or end, be destroyed, be created, or have any connection whatsoever with zero.
Well, let me share something with you, because I've done a fair amount of thinking about a massive spinning black hole that might be at the center of a galaxy.
Okay.
You know, a black hole is collapsed matter.
Did Tom leave?
No, I'm still here.
Okay.
But I'm definitely enjoying the conversation, and I probably I'll hang up now and continue.
Yeah, you might as well just listen on the computer. I hope we answered your question.
It's sort of a learning process for me, but as I am listening to you guys continue to talk, especially in the last half hour here, it's making more sense. It seems like it's a very complex concept, and the only way to define it is to sort of look at it or give describe different aspects of it from different perspectives.
What I want you to do, Tom, is I want you to go to Marco Roden's website. I want you to look up that sunflower map, and then I want you to play the archive back while you're looking at that, and you'll be able to understand what we're talking about, because once you see the graphic that has been created from Marco's mathematics, you'll see the way this electricity constructively interferes with itself and actually compounds the energy that it's actually inducing from spirit.
Fascinating, fascinating. Thanks again for the program, and I'll definitely do that.
And Tom, I do have a video, and the first 2 hours of the video goes into simple detail on the arithmetic of it.
Oh yeah, why don't you tell him and the rest of our listeners how to get that video?
A video goes into extreme detail on the base 10 counting system on arithmetic. The multiplication table shows how numbers, how I take the flat standard multiplication table, I then turn them into single digits, and then I warp it and morph it into the shape of a donut. I call it opening up the black hole, and it's a great way to learn arithmetic. It's called vortex-based mathematics, and if you do your calculations right, you actually go through the event horizon and out the other side of a black hole and out through a white hole. But anyway, if you're interested in it, what should I suggest? The best thing is to go to RodenMath.com, and I think it has information about ordering it.
Yeah,
there.
I think there is a buy now button where it describes it, and it goes directly to PayPal. You can use PayPal, or you can use your credit card. And gosh, if we could sell about 5,000 of those tonight, I think that would help Marco out quite a bit.
I'm going to put it up online so people can actually download.
And Marco and I will work out a way. We'll put that video in our online store as well, and try to get a few million people a week to look at that.
I have Tom.
Yes.
I'm going to poise the question that you asked me to Brooks. I know you're going to hang up and be listening online.
Right.
I mean, on radio, on air. But, Brooks, since I feel that you have a comfortable grip on what I've discovered, and bear in mind that I don't have no monopoly or exclusive of this. It's just I was the one who kind of, like, pulled the rug up and exposed it. What is the implications to you, and what does it mean to you, given a new tool, a new tool that you can then apply to your profession, towards what you do? How do you understand the discovery? Because I'd be fascinated to understand, since you understand the implications that numbers make a toroidal coil. I mean, does this have any
Well, here's what I gather from it, and I'm going to talk about it maybe in a couple aspects. One is of course, the practical applications, like Tom is talking about. How can I put one of these babies in a little tiny circuit that only needs a few milliamps to run,
mm-hmm.
and literally induce electricity out of the ether of space? That's, of course, extremely valuable. I'd say about 90% of the circuitry that we have in the world is less than 10 milliamps. It would be easy to take all of that off the grid and have to stop burning oil for that reason. the other implications are much more sweeping than that. With a coil of sufficient size, enough wire, you could draw literally the power of heaven to earth, and you could power magnificent things that we can only imagine. The third aspect is that of the black hole creation. As I was getting ready to allude, when a lighted piece of matter, let's say we have a sun 10,000 times the size of ours, when it collapses, its rotation accelerates. That's conservation of momentum. And so my contention is that black holes are all spinning at their maximum speed, their maximum possible speed, although that centrifugal force isn't enough to overcome the gravity that has collapsed it in the first place. It has changed the shape of that black hole. It is not a sphere like a black marble. It's more like a black donut in space.
See, that's exactly what I believe, too.
And 99%, if not all, of the matter that makes up the chaos inside that event horizon is slammed up against the event horizon like that donut, which leaves the hole in the middle. Now, you're saying that any matter that approaches that black hole is not going to go through the center but be wound up in the coils of the donut.
Sure, filaments, that's right.
And my theory is a little different than that, in the sense that if the hole is big enough, let's say a million times the distance of the orbit of Pluto, in other words, a million times the diameter of our solar system, still quite small compared to the galaxy, but fairly good size. If you were to approach that axially, a lot like the matter that's coming out of the quasar, you should be able to pass through the warp of space in a straight line from one point in space to another point in space, or from one universe to another universe, without being tidally distended by its gravity and without being annihilated by touching any matter whatsoever. Even though it might take you more time than this universe is going to last, you would be able to travel from one point to another, aging at a normal rate relative to yourself, and end up somewhere else way, way beyond where you could have if you'd have jumped in a titanium can and traveled at the speed of light. Now, I hope I made that clear, but if this is the main implication that I see with a intergalactic thrust system like what you have alluded to. You could literally take one of these coils into space, either power it up with spirit or power it up with sunlight and solar cells or whatever, create a black hole, and then travel through it, or use the black hole as a thruster to travel across the galaxy in a fraction the amount of time that we're doing now.
Fascinating. Thank you again for taking my call.
Thank you, Tom, and hope you have a good evening.
You too. We'll talk to you later, you guys.
Your voice and your question is now recorded for all time.
Okay. Thanks again. Good night.
Good evening.
Brooks?
Yeah.
So my goal, as well, is to apply that same principle. How's this for a reach of thought? But I apply it to biology, because the same principles is how diseases communicate. I mean, if you look at the shape of viruses and diseases, they are protein folding into toroids.
Sure.
I mean, it's classic, the toroidal shape on the microbiological level. And they're all being controlled by the same principles again, of the energies going through these holes, through these vortices. These, what I call, underpinning nested vortices. So I believe this principle could be, these flex fields could be controlled to literally end diseases, control diseases, create health.
Well, I think you're exactly right. If you coupled your technology with nanotechnology, the actual mechanical constructing of drugs or treatments or various biochemistry, do that mechanochemically, I think, you know, we're very close to curing our first virus. I think we can prevent virus by capitalizing on the immunological system of the human body, you know, teach it to preempt an attack by a virus. But we can't cure any virus. We haven't cracked the code yet.
Well, if I ever could just focus, that's what I would do. My day, you know, I usually don't sit down at my computer till after sunset. I have a long day.
I understand where you're coming from. I keep plants out of the red during the day and do this on the weekends.
What city are you in right now?
Right now I'm in Charlotte, North Carolina, but I am relocating to Western Kentucky.
Mm-hmm. I've never been to that part of the United States. Although I see a lot of things for sale from home furnishings and stuff from that state.
Oh, yeah. It used to be the textile capital, and I guess before that, Boston used to be the textile capital, and they moved south because of labor constraints or cost of labor, and now that labor has moved overseas, and so now there's a labor vacuum in this area.
What are you going to find in Kentucky?
Kentucky is where my wife's parents live,
mm-hmm.
and it's not got quite as good a dark sky as North Carolina, but somebody or something up there needs us, so we're relocating up there.
Can I offer my contribution for non-perishable food?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because, you know, I live in Hawaii, and the city I live in was hit by a tsunami. It was devastated. The first three blocks now is all just highway and grass because they wouldn't let them rebuild the houses.
Wow.
It's called Hilo. Hilo Bay was wiped out by a tsunami. We have this clock in the middle of town standing there that doesn't work, marking the hour that it hit. They left it as a monument. But I've always been trained by where I grew up in the city. There was always bunkers with food stores and stuff. And I've learned that the two best foods, the first one is honey. And I buy honey here in Hawaii in 60-pound, 5-gallon buckets.
Wow.
And it lasts forever, honey. It's non-perishable.
How do you keep honey fresh?
Well, you know the story of the Jewish people wandering for 40 years through the desert with Moses?
Mm-hmm.
You know, did you know that that's what they were all starving, and what they found in the religious account was they found honey? Have you ever heard that story?
Yes, I have.
And that's what they lived on. You just, if you just buy it in the 5-gallon pail as I do, you just don't open it up. Or if any container you get, once it's sealed, the trick is you don't open it.
Mm.
Once you open it, then you want to use it. But if you leave it sealed, people seal things and prepare things in different ways. There's so many different ways. Honey typically, or a lot of things are heated, and that sanitizes it. Also, if you you can take CO2. What's CO2? What's it called? Ice? Cold ice?
Dry ice.
If you take dry ice and you put it in a bucket, the nitrous oxide, is that the gas, pushes out the oxygen and kills anything that will grow. So if you're saving like grains or something, and you put dry ice in the bottom of it, it pushes the air out the top.
Yeah.
Because it's heavier than air. Anyway, the first food was honey. You ready for the second food?
Sure.
Last 100 years. And my view is you never have an emergency food that is that only has a 5 or 10 year lifespan, because you never know when you're going to need it. And typically it's a lot longer. So I only use things that are permanently storageable, even 100 or 200 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, I don't eat the stuff, but peanut butter, or even better, a nut butter. But I have here where I'm at, I have over 500 pounds of peanut butter unopened. It'll never go bad. It's sealed. And between peanut butter and honey, the stuff will last forever.
Now, we store a lot of peanut butter, and we store a lot of red winter wheat. And I do have a wheat grinder. But I have found that we don't consume a lot of wheat. We do eat our weight in peanut butter each year. But I like the idea of the honey. That's a good idea. I am, if there are any people out there listening, I am looking for a food storage company to use as an affiliate. I have interviewed a couple. I have looked at several. I have pretty high standards for it. So I am. If you're interested, you can contact me at info at x2- www.ampletune-radio.com. If you're within listening distance, or listening, actually, if you're on this planet or slightly off this planet, you're within listening distance. I had a couple other questions here, and we only have about 10 minutes left. We talked earlier about the double vortex generator. And I guess if there was one thing that had implications, universe or galactic implications, it would be this double vortex generator. Sort of like it would be sort of like a Stargate. If you could build it on the right scale, you might be able to move a capsule from one point in space to another, or you might even be able to carry the black hole with you, warping space as you go. I don't know. It would seem that one would have to have the skill of negotiating the black hole, because if you can be annihilated by it if you don't know how to use it correctly. I don't know how intergalactic spacecraft travel across the universe, but I know how they don't do it. I don't think they take 20,000 years to travel across the galaxy at the speed of light, and that would just get you to the closest large star cluster. There must be a faster way, and it's quite possible that that Marco's theories are the key to this kind of travel. So my question is, how do you think that a double vortex generator could be built using your coil technology?
I think it's a very easy thing to do. I don't think there's anything to it. It's just a matter of having the people, the money to pay the people. The technology, the equipment can all be, you know, off the shelf. There's nothing tricky about the, you don't have to,
how large would
retool a whole new type of technology that, I'm sorry, go ahead.
How big can you make these?
My view is always smaller the better. And I believe that size, as far as output to size proportion, I think because of the nature of this discovery, that you can, with something very small, you can accomplish more than anything that's ever been done. So I never work with anything that's bigger than that you could easily work with on your laboratory's desktop. So, I will say this. The first coils that were ever made, there were three different made. And because the principle wasn't fairly understood and because we were following conventional practices, they were each bigger, and the largest one was many more windings. And yes, the largest one, the output did increase by, like, I don't know, I can't remember, like 120% or something. But when the principle is properly understood, if you can take it to its ultimate comprehension, my answer would be is size is not a factor.
Well, I guess I'm thinking about it in a different way, not economy of scale, but one plant that I worked at, we had these large, they were called the Centac air compressors. They generated a little over 5,000 standard cubic feet per minute, and they did it with a turbine that spun about 60,000 RPM. But the driver to that was a 1,200 horsepower, 4,160 volt engine, and it actually took 1 million watts to fire it up, and it consumed about 1 million watts every 2 hours. I imagine one time when I was pushing the start button on that thing one night, how big the inductive field was from that coil on that motor. It was about 6 feet across. And I thought to myself tonight, if I could apply that kind of power to a coil, say, 100 yards across, wound with several miles of copper wire in a Roden construction, and I applied the voltage to it, what would be the effect?
So
would it create an Einstein-Rosen bridge?
Yeah. I never put the paper up online. It was written by Oscar Chu. It was comparing my work to a Rosen bridge. It was how to make a simulated black hole to duplicate a Rosen bridge effect. My answer is if you use the Rodin winding configuration, you can essentially make an artificial man-made black hole in the form of even my most primitive coils, as you saw with those magnetic fields,
mm-hmm.
it was creating a perfect vortex. That if it was made properly, you literally hold the universe in your hand. You know, Keith Watson, he accidentally drowned 10 men once. He was in charge of monitoring the Bikini Island detonations, nuclear blasts, when we were experimenting, and he put the ship too close to the, zero point or whatever. And the ship went down, everybody drowned. It had a horrible impact on him personally, and he became extremely cautious. And he once said to me, he says, you know, I believe what you have does work. And he said, you have to be very careful. He said the universe was created by a vacuum fluxation, and you can create another vacuum fluxation and suck the universe back in on itself. But I call it a localized space-time explosion. I think that it is controllable. Classic weaponry research talks about these as being uncontrollable even to the operator, and that they were all so barbaric they must be destroyed. I believe they are controllable and manageable.
They may be. When we talk about the creation of a bridge like this, often, at least mathematically, we talk about it being supported by exotic material. In other words, made of neutron star material, which actually we don't have any of that on this planet, but mathematically we can do just about anything we want to do. And the problem with the model was once the opening was made, there were vacuum fluctuations between one universe and another, one dimension and another, and it actually destroyed itself. It collapsed in upon itself. It wasn't necessarily destructive to either one of the universes, but the interesting thing was that because you had usurped light speed, you'd actually traveled across more distance than you could travel in the same amount of time at the speed of light. You exceeded time. You actually went backward in time, because going there and coming back, mathematically, you actually arrived before you left. So the paradox was that the black hole actually collapsed before you ever formed it. Now, mind you, all this is theoretical, and the idea, that the thing that fascinates me about your idea is it's so similar to my theory of black holes being induced from the outside, not the inside, or warp tubes being induced from the outside, not the inside, by the spinning singularities of these massive spinning black holes. But what fascinates me about your idea is that you're actually creating the vortex using a unique design of coil. And that makes a stable black hole, so it doesn't collapse in on itself.
Right.
But it would allow the vacuum fluctuations to occur nonetheless. The question is, would they be controllable? It's a little bit like walking up to a big speaker with the microphone in your hand. If you don't make too much noise, then there's not a feedback loop that's created. But once that is created, you've amplified the noise, shoved it right back down the microphone, which goes right back into the amplifier, and before too long, you've destroyed the amplifier or the ears of everyone in the room.
I completely know how to control it and navigate with it. I can make it turn and go in any direction. The reason is because at the very heart of it, the most beautiful aspect of it mathematically, or the most esoteric, is looking at it. I call it
We have about 20 seconds, so.
Okay. Well, they're the spires of spirit. Even spirit creates spires. Even the inertia ether has spires. And if you know the harmonics, how to tap into the spires of the ether, you can control the whole black hole.
Wow. Well, Marco, I have thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. I can't believe 3 hours has gone already. But we will definitely have you back on another time. And I appreciate
you've been of invaluable assistance and help to me, and I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you.
Remember, Earth Explorers, who you are. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe. So try to do it on purpose, every day. Life is immensely valuable. Reach out to the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. Before long, you will have saved the planet. This is your host, Brooks Agnew, with X Squared Radio, saying, peace, Earth Explorers. See you next Sunday evening at 5 p.m. Eastern.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others' endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.